You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
Guns and Butter.
This is Guns and Butter.
There's something happening, yeah. Yeah, yeah. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there.
So we're really focusing here on a fundamental redefinition and reframing of the entire abortion issue so that we focus off of the fetus and actually off of the woman onto an organ, the uterus. And we see that forced pregnancy and childbirth is a special case of forced organ donation, which would, as the judge in the McFall versus Shimp case, actually undercut the entire foundation of U.S. and American federal law.
I'm Bonnie Faulkner. Today on Guns and Butter, Barbara Honecker. Today's show, We the Men versus We the People. Barbara Honecker is a leading researcher, author, and public speaker. She is a former senior military affairs journalist at the Naval Postgraduate School, the premier science, technology, and national security affairs graduate research university of the Department of Defense. She held high-level positions in the federal government during the Reagan administration, including White House policy analyst, special assistant to the assistant to the president for domestic policy, and director of the Attorney General's Anti-Discrimination Law Review at the U.S. Department of Justice. Her pioneering book, October Surprise, The Deep Story Behind the Iran Side of the Iran-Contra Scandal, was subsequently confirmed by formerly classified documents and led to a full subpoena power U.S. House of Representatives investigation. In light of the recent violence at a Planned Parenthood clinic in Colorado Springs, today we discuss her experiences in the Reagan White House, championing women's reproductive and civil rights. The Associated Press reports that, according to the National Abortion Foundation, there have been 8 murders and more than 220 bombings and arson attacks at abortion facilities in the U.S. since 1977. Barbara Honecker, welcome.
Well, thank you, Bonnie.
Barbara, you were a White House policy analyst and the top aide to President Ronald Reagan's chief domestic policy advisor, beginning with Reagan's inauguration, January 20th, 1981. Before we go into your responsibilities in that position, could you briefly tell us how you ended up in the Reagan White House?
I'd be happy to do that, Bonnie. And just before I do, I'd like to give a little context for this interview. I'd like to begin just by saying that my purpose in doing this interview is to actually prove to the American people, based on my documented inside experience at the highest levels of the Reagan White House and Department of Justice, that the so-called pro-life position on the abortion issue is actually the moral low ground, not the moral high ground, as they would mislead you to believe, and to put forward a core fundamental reframing of the entire abortion issue that is urgently needed to prevent the ongoing culture war from turning into an outright violent civil war in this country. So with that context, how did I ever end up in the West Wing of the Reagan White House? That's a very good question. Very briefly, I was working at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University in late 1970s to early 1981 for a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution whose name was Dr. Martin Anderson. He had a very high-level position at the Hoover Institution and had hired me to be his research associate, researcher, and co-writer on his books on the military draft. And one day, Ronald Reagan, who was then no longer governor, he had been 3 terms as governor of California, he was now a private citizen, and he was made an honorary fellow of the Hoover Institution, came into our office and asked Martin Anderson if he would be Reagan's chief domestic policy advisor in Reagan's upcoming third run for the Republican nomination in 1980. And my boss, Martin Anderson, said yes, and I went off with him.
And in that position, as the top aide to President Ronald Reagan's chief domestic policy advisor, one of your portfolios, the 2 major issue areas you were responsible for, was women's rights. Is that correct?
Yes, it is. As a little background, I was a high-level political appointee in both the Reagan White House and Department of Justice. The positions I served in were policy analyst in the White House, domestic policy office, and I was also the top aide to the chief domestic policy advisor to the president, beginning with Reagan's inauguration on January 20th, 1981. I had also been at the top levels of the 1980 Reagan-Bush senior presidential campaign at their campaign headquarters in Arlington, Virginia, and was also then on the top floor of the Reagan-Bush senior transition team once Reagan and Bush senior won the presidential election on November 4th, 1980. In the White House, my desk was actually on the second floor, almost over the Oval Office. Later in the administration, beginning in 1982, I was also dual-hatted as the director of the Attorney General's Task Force on Gender Equality in federal law at the U.S. Department of Justice, which officially implemented then-candidate Reagan's first promise to the American people in his acceptance speech at the 1980 Republican National Convention, and that promise was that he and the Republicans alleged that they would come up with a, quote, better way than the ERA, unquote, to achieve equal rights for women in the United States, and that that way would be to, one by one, identify all laws, regulations, policies, practices, and procedures in all almost 50 federal departments and agencies that discriminate against girls and women in the U.S. and correct them one by one. That's like trying to end slavery plantation by plantation. So that was my job inside the White House and the Department of Justice.
Well, did President Reagan support the Equal Rights Amendment? And if not, did he give a reason?
Oh, boy, that's a good one. No, he didn't, at least politically in public. But the real reason in the lead up to the 1980 election, presidential election, was, of course, because of a cynical electoral strategy by the Republicans to, for the first time, politicize the right-wing Christians in this country, the fundamentalist Christians, to try to increase the Republican voting base in an attempt to regain the White House for the Republicans. Now, it's very important to give some historical context for this sea change in American politics. The 1980 Republican convention platform meeting, at which I was at the Republican National Convention in Detroit, I was the only woman at the table at that meeting. I was there because they all assumed that I was one of them, which I wasn't. Now, there's an interesting background to that. It turns out that Dr. Martin Anderson, who is a libertarian and a longtime supporter and close associate of Ayn Rand, was also pro-choice and had almost single-handedly ended the peacetime draft, where we went to an all-voluntary military under the Nixon administration. So, I was the chief aide at the Republican National Convention in 1980 to a man who was pro-choice. So was his wife, Annalise Anderson, who is still to this day a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution. Dr. Anderson unfortunately died this January 2015. Both Martin Anderson and his wife, who were the top domestic policy aides to Reagan in the 1980 presidential campaign, were both pro-choice. Now, many of the men around the table at the Republican platform convention platform meeting, where I was the note taker and the recorder, they assumed, I suppose, that Martin Anderson, who was there, was also so-called pro-life, but he was not. So that's why I was there. And it was at that table that the Republican Party, for the first time, made the decision not to support the Equal Rights Amendment. Prior to that, both the Democratic and Republican parties had supported the ERA. But the ERA at that point in the summer of 1980 was getting very close to having enough states' ratifications to actually pass into a new constitutional amendment. And so the Republicans changed their position and for the first time came out against the ERA at that table. And it was like someone had stabbed me in the gut with a knife. So the bottom line answer is, for all of these atrocious reasons, no, Ronald Reagan was not, at least publicly, in favor of the Equal Rights Amendment.
And what about the subject of abortion? What did you learn while at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University about why Reagan, when he was governor of California, first made abortion legal and why he later changed his mind and came out against it?
Yes, this is extremely important for people to understand, and very few people either know this or remember it from that period of time. When Reagan was governor of California, he made abortion legal in this country under certain circumstances, therapeutic abortions. But that was, as the so-called pro-life side says, the camel's nose in the tent, which then opened up completely. Well, shockingly, I learned while I was at the Hoover Institution as a research fellow there for Dr. Martin Anderson in the late 70s and up to 1980, that then Governor Reagan, who signed one of the first U.S. state laws, if not the first state law, making abortion legal in the U.S., which was in California, I received documented proof that as governor he had done so for a purely crass political reason. And that reason was, believe it or not, I'm now going to prove this to you, they were hoping that by legalizing abortion, that future and potential and likely Democratic Party voters would more likely be aborted than future Republican voters. I know.
Barb, how could that be?
This is a fact, and I'm going to tell you how I know it, and I have the documents to prove it. I have the documents from Reagan's governorship that were in the Hoover Institution's collection of his gubernatorial papers, where he placed them when he became an honorary fellow at the Hoover Institution, proving this. And these are minutes from his then California Governor Reagan's Health and Human Services subcabinet meetings. Now, I was a research associate at the Hoover Institution, as I said, with Dr. Martin Anderson, who later became President Reagan's first chief domestic policy advisor in the White House. But at that time, in the late 70s up to mid-1980, I was a research associate at the Hoover Institution. Another high-level research associate at the Hoover, who happened to be a friend of mine, her job was to go through and organize Reagan's gubernatorial documents for their archives. Over lunch one day, she told me that she was shocked, that she had found something that disturbed her so much that she needed to show it to me. She had made copies and gave them to me, which I still have. They are minutes of then-Governor Reagan's Health and Human Services, as I recall the title, Health and Human Services subcabinet meetings, recording the reports to the subcabinet meeting by Reagan's then head of his Health and Human Services, or Health Department, and his name was Earl Bryan. And just for the record, this same Earl Bryan was later found guilty of federal crimes and was put in prison for them. Now, what did these documents say? Shockingly, what they showed was they showed the discussion first in the subcabinet meetings before Reagan legalized therapeutic abortions in California. And the discussion was that they wanted to see what would happen, that there was a lot of pressure to legalize therapeutic abortions, and so it would probably be a good political thing to do. And Reagan did this. Now, some time went by, and the shocking document was the second one. The second minutes of the Health and Human Services subcabinet meeting, sometime later, a couple of years later or so, Earl Bryan reported to Reagan and some of his other top aides at this meeting in the minutes that Governor Reagan, a terrible thing has happened. This is a not verbatim, of course, but it's the gist of it. Governor Reagan, a terrible thing has happened. We were assuming that poor minority women were going to be having all these abortions, but Governor Reagan, there's some good white Republican wives who are having abortions. We can't have this. And so Reagan came out against abortion. And that's the real reason he came out, for a crass political reason. They were hoping that legalizing abortion in California would differentially cause future potential and likely Democratic Party voters to be aborted relative to Republican Party voters. It is that simple, and I can prove it to you. Now, I would like to go on record saying this is basically the same mentality about abortion as Adolf Hitler and the Nazis in World War II in Germany. And the reason is that, and people don't know this, Hitler outlawed abortion in Nazi Germany, but only for so-called good white Aryan women.
Well, now, wouldn't it also be the case that he would have signed that abortion bill simply to win elections? Was that an issue to win re-election in California or not?
They were just trying to prevent likely future Democratic voters from being born.
So was there also a political concern that in being reelected as governor of California that he'd get more votes if he legalized abortion, or was that not the issue?
I can't answer that question. It wasn't in the sub-cabinet meeting minutes. I'm just going by the documentation.
So he changed his mind on abortion when he was still governor?
Yes.
I see.
Yes.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Barbara Honecker. Today's show, We the Men versus We the People. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Describe the white paper on the abortion issue you wrote for President Reagan's chief domestic policy advisor when you were in the White House. What were your conclusions? How did you argue them? And what was the surprising reaction of the president's chief domestic advisor?
I'm going to begin by telling you how the president's chief domestic policy advisor reacted to my white paper on the abortion issue, reframing the abortion issue, and then I'm going to tell you and your listeners how I reframed the abortion issue. Because once I tell you how he reacted, you're going to want to know what was in my white paper. So, when I presented the argument I'm about to give you, which completely reframes the so-called abortion issue, when I gave that to Dr. Martin Anderson, who was then Reagan's chief domestic policy advisor, in the White House in a formal white paper that he had requested me to write as a policy analyst, he said, about a week later after he'd read it, he called me into his office and he held it in his hand and he said, Barbara, this is incredible. This is the only argument I have ever seen that could change Ronald Reagan's mind on abortion. And that is an exact quote. Well, you can imagine how pleased and excited I was. And I said, Marty, that's great. So when are you going to give it to the president? And there was a long pause. And this man, for whom I had great respect, he had almost single-handedly ended the peacetime draft in this country, which I consider to be immoral, and so did he, of course. After a long pause, he said, well, I'm not going to give it to him. And there was another long pause because I was so shocked. And I said, but Marty, why not? To which Martin Anderson replied, because I can't give it to him. Another pause, Marty, why not? He said, I can't give it to the president because it would change his mind on abortion. Stunned, after another long pause, I asked what he possibly could mean by that. And Dr. Anderson said, right over the Oval Office, if President Reagan came out on the other side of this issue, we would lose the religious fundamentalist Christian vote, and the Republican Party would never win another election. And he was right about that. Now, you can imagine that that also was like someone hitting me with a knife in the stomach. But I stayed in my job because, in a way, like Edward Snowden, I just knew that I had to stay. I had to stay on the inside until I had the actual documentation proving the moral bankruptcy of the domestic policies of this Reagan-Bush senior administration, which I did. Now I'm going to tell you how I reframed the entire abortion issue in this white paper requested of me by the chief domestic policy advisor to President Reagan. As a very fundamental shift, almost a paradigm shift in the entire way of thinking about the so-called abortion or reproductive freedom issue, I'm going to preface that by saying that the so-called right to life claims of the right to life movement, the claim that a fetus should have a right to life, is not about a right to life. It's actually about a right to a womb, about a right to a uterus. So the right to life is really about forcing a woman's pregnancy, and you do that by forcing her to, for 9 months, use her womb against her will if she doesn't want to continue the pregnancy. So right to life is really, by the so-called pro-life movement, a demand for forced uterus donation, which is what forced pregnancy and childbirth is. But this is literally biological slavery. It is literally forced labor. And I don't mean to say that as a pun lightly. Labor and childbirth. It is literally forced labor. And this position from the Republican base of the Republican Party is from the same party that was founded, of all things, by Abraham Lincoln, who fought the Civil War and ended slavery, at least officially, in this country. Now, the great power of adding no forced organ use to the current privacy rights basis of the Roe v. Wade Supreme Court decision that undergirds women's reproductive rights at this time in this country is that the foundation of the right to end pregnancies is that it completely undercuts the currently favored argument of the pro-lifers that if a fetus were to become a legal person, that almost all abortions, except maybe to save the life of the mother, would have to be made illegal. But the reason this argument does not hold water and should never hold water is that to force 9 months of uterus donation, of organ donation by a pregnant woman, to force pregnancy and childbirth against her will on a pregnant woman, would be to give an unborn fetus far greater rights than we now give to full adult American citizens of either gender, women or men. Now let me prove that to you. In my white paper for Dr. Anderson, that he read and said this is the only thing I've ever seen that could change Ronald Reagan's mind on abortion, and that's why he wasn't and couldn't give it to him, because it would change his mind on abortion, likely. I'm going to tell you about a very important case that's very little known in this country called McFaul versus Shimp. I quoted this case liberally in my white paper. McFaul, M-C, capital F-A-L-L, versus Shimp, S-H-I-M-P. Now, the McFaul versus Shimp case is extremely important, and even more important was the judge's decision in that case. That was a case in which Mr. McFaul was dying, and he needed a transplant. He needed a transplant of his bone marrow in order to save his life. And he found out that his cousin, Mr. Shimp, was a compatible donor. And he asked Mr. Shimp if he would donate some bone marrow, which wouldn't kill Mr. Shimp, but it would inconvenience him and put him through some pain and some recovery period. Well, Mr. Shimp, after great thought and talking to his family, said no. So Mr. McFaul sued Mr. Shimp to try to force him to be strapped onto an operating table and to have his bone marrow forcibly taken from his body to be put into Mr. McFaul's body to save Mr. McFaul's life. Well, the judge in this case, when he looked at this, and the most important thing I should mention, in this argument, Mr. McFaul, who wanted to force the organ or bodily tissue donation, in quotes, donation from Mr. Shimp, his cousin, the main argument he used to force it was the third trimester portion of Roe v. Wade, which is the only part of Roe v. Wade that gives an exception to the otherwise almost absolute right under Roe v. Wade of a pregnant woman to end her pregnancy. In the third trimester of Roe v. Wade, she's not allowed to under all circumstances, only to save her own health. Okay? So they used Roe v. Wade, a portion of Roe v. Wade, to try to force a full-grown male citizen of the United States to have his bodily tissue taken forcibly from his body and given to another full adult male citizen of the United States. Well, Bonnie, I wish you could read, and I will give you to put on your website, the short decision of that judge in that case. But the bottom line and the gist of that decision was the judge ruled against Mr. McFaul. He said, even though it would be hard for any of us, this is the gist of it, even though it would be difficult for any of us to imagine that someone like Mr. Shimp might decide not to help his cousin, Mr. McFaul, to force him to give up one or more of his organs or bodily tissues against his will with the force of the state, let alone his entire bodily processes, to save the life of another person would undercut the absolute foundation of our entire system of law. Now, this is extremely important, and I'm going to give you that decision to have on your website. This is incredibly important and very ironic, actually, as this latest round of escalating violence against abortion clinics that also provide reproductive health care of all kinds for women, and especially poor women, was actually triggered by Planned Parenthood's, the expose of Planned Parenthood's recent provision of fetal organs for research purposes. So we're really focusing here on a fundamental redefinition and reframing of the entire abortion issue so that we focus off of the fetus and actually off of the woman onto an organ, the uterus. And we see that forced pregnancy and childbirth is a special case of forced organ donation, which would, as the judge in the McFall versus Shimp case, actually undercut the entire foundation of not only U.S. and American federal law, but also all of British statutory and common law. So the great and growing danger in this post-9/11 surveillance state that routinely invades the privacy of every American on a daily 24/7 basis, the danger of basing reproductive freedom and rights on Roe v. Wade, or only on Roe v. Wade, which the Supreme Court decision was founded merely on an inferred so-called right to privacy in the 14th Amendment. This is extremely dangerous today. Reproductive rights have to be refounded on a far more fundamental legal and moral basis. And that new basis, additional basis, beyond and in addition to privacy rights, has to be on the absolute immorality of any and all forced organ taking and use, because the uterus is an organ. And to force pregnancy and childbirth is to force labor and is to force organ donation, because the uterus, the womb, is an organ. The Supreme Court and the lower courts have repeatedly and consistently ruled in this country also that it is illegal to force any American, any person, to give even a single drop of their blood to save another person's life. With the exception, there are a few exceptions. For instance, forced DNA samples for determining paternity in a pregnancy and other biological samples taken, for instance, to try to contain an epidemic. A mother, under our current Supreme Court and lower court rulings, cannot even be forced to give a single drop of her own blood to save her own newly born child's life against her will, although she would, of course, certainly almost voluntarily do so. The important concept here is voluntarism. But to force pregnancy and childbirth, therefore, in this fundamental reframing, is to force 9 months of taking by the federal government or the state government, not only of the uterus of an adult American citizen, the mother, on behalf of a fetus that is not yet separately alive, which is not even a born citizen like the woman. And by the way, the 14th Amendment explicitly states that only persons born are U.S. citizens. But it would also allow 9 months of forced non-voluntary taking of her entire bodily processes, which is what pregnancy is. American women themselves also, most people do not know this, were only formally recognized themselves as persons, legal persons, under the 14th Amendment by the Supreme Court in the early 1970s, which happened to be in a case brought by a female Air Force officer.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Barbara Honecker. Today's show, We the Men versus We the People. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now, Barbara, were there other arguments that you made in your white paper besides the argument of forced organ donation in order to argue your case in favor of abortion rights?
Yes, there was. It's not exactly on point to this interview, but yes, there was a second argument. And Dr. Anderson, when he told me that my white paper was the only arguments that could change President Reagan's mind on abortion, it included both arguments. The other major argument was that I actually used the data from the Centers for Disease Control, the CDC, and worked with the White House librarians. And what I did was I compared the death versus, in other words, the mortality rate and the wound rate of males going to war in every one of our American wars, from the Revolutionary War to the Civil War to World War I to World War II, to the mortality rate, the danger of dying from so-called routine pregnancy and childbirth by American women, and to the wound rate, the equivalent of the wound rate, which I just determined, I had to make a decision. I decided that the parallel to the wound rate of men going to war, Americans going to war over the history of the United States, would be something like the pregnancy complication rate of women who had to go into the hospital and stay there for more than a day. So I did this, and what I found, and I made a chart in my white paper, and it showed that pregnancy, so-called routine pregnancy and childbirth, is extremely dangerous. And we know for a fact that it's far more dangerous to the life and health of a woman than having an abortion.
What were some of your experiences at the Reagan White House with other staff members regarding women's reproductive rights and women's rights in general?
Well, that's a great question too, Bonnie. Now, to answer that question, I just want to remind your listeners that I was the highest ranking top political appointee for gender equality and women's rights in the federal government under the first half of the first Reagan-Bush senior administration, with my office effectively over the Oval Office on the second floor of the West Wing. So this was a very high-level position. Now, I'm going to tell you about an incident in the West Wing of the White House, actually in the domestic policy office itself, that involved another policy analyst. His name was Gary Bauer. Now, Gary Bauer, to this day, is a major advocate for the so-called pro-life position and anti-abortion position in this country. He's very well known in those circles. Well, when I was in the White House, Gary Bauer's wife was pregnant, and she had her baby. Gary Bauer was told that his wife had just had her baby. He was on the phone. He got off the phone, and he was angry. And those of us who worked with him in the White House said, "What's going on? Why are you angry?" He was furious that his wife had been given painkillers during childbirth. Some one of us, it wasn't me, but another woman who worked with us in the domestic end of things in the White House, said, but why should you be upset with that? And with indignation in his voice about his own wife, he said, well, pain in childbirth is the moral punishment for all women for Eve getting Adam to eat the apple. And without the pain of childbirth, he further complained, women will have everything. Unquote. Well, Gary Bauer, God help us, soon took over from Dr. Martin Anderson, my boss. He became the chief domestic policy advisor to President Reagan, two domestic policy advisors after Martin Anderson, when Dr. Anderson resigned in about February of 1982 and returned to the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. So that's just one example, Bonnie, of the mentality of this fundamentalist Christian, and I use that with a KKK Christian, this fundamentalist KKK Christian mentality, which is like an American Taliban mentality within the Reagan White House. It was shocking. It was obscene. It was immoral. And I committed myself to expose it as soon as I had the documentation to prove it. And I did, as you're about to see.
You resigned publicly from the Reagan administration. What led to your public resignation and the week-long mainstream media publicity that surrounded it?
Well, that's a really important question, Bonnie, and I'd like to preface my answer by just saying that if you can imagine someone like myself who is a very committed progressive politically, I was in a great moral dilemma the whole 2.5 years I was in that administration, and I decided, very much like I imagined Edward Snowden and people like him, whistleblowers, that I really needed to bide my time until I had documented proof of what was going on inside the administration in an attempt to attack all civil rights in the United States before I resigned, and then to release that proof to the American public, and that's what I did. So there was really an accumulation of shocking affronts to my conscience and to equal rights by the very highest officials of the Reagan-Bush senior administration that I had personally experienced in meetings with them inside the White House and the Department of Justice at the highest levels, including Reagan's Attorney General, Ed Meese, who had previously been Reagan's White House counsel, one of the troika inside the White House. He moved on to be Attorney General. So given that context, I just want you to know that after about 2.5 years in the administration, what happened to actually trigger my public resignation? And I would say that I was the first public resignation of conscience from the Reagan-Bush senior administration. As I mentioned earlier, my formal position was head of the so-called ERA alternative that then presidential candidate Ronald Reagan had promised the American people in his acceptance speech at the Republican National Convention in the summer of 1980. It was the president's promise to the American people. To carry out that promise in federal law, at the Department of Justice, where I was double-hatted, I had an office in the White House and in the Department of Justice, my job, which I did, was to research, using a very sophisticated computer program, to research the entire text of all of the U.S. Code of Federal Law and the text of all of the U.S. Code of Regulations and find all examples of gender discrimination against girls and women, or for that matter, against boys and men, but there was very little, maybe 1%, 99% against girls and women, in the entire Code of Federal Law. And I did that. And when I was done with that research, which produced computerized outputs, that I then had to go over and produce the actual documents, the actual reports that were then published by the government printing office and constitute 7 volumes that were published by the government printing office. Now, I have these 7 volumes to this day. These 7 volumes were the factual foundation of the so-called ERA alternative that President Reagan had promised in his acceptance speech. And that so-called ERA, just the alternative to remind you, the president said that he wanted to, instead of the ERA, instead of a constitutional amendment, which the Republican Party had for the first time come out against, he wanted to identify every law and regulation in the federal code that discriminated against females, girls or women, and propose a correction to them that Congress would then have to vote on one by one. This was kind of like ending slavery plantation by plantation instead of with the Emancipation Proclamation. So that was my job, to identify all of those and publish them, which I did with a government printing office. The next step, just before my decision to resign from the White House and the Justice Department, I took those 7 volumes, I had them delivered to President Reagan's chief of staff to give to the president, to let him know that his ERA alternative, the factual foundation, the first step, had been completed. And I had those 7 volumes, which stand about 1.5 feet high. That's how many hundreds and hundreds of laws and regulations that discriminate against girls and women in this country to this day, because they still haven't been corrected. I had those delivered to Jim Baker, President Reagan's chief of staff in the White House. About a week went by, and I got a call at my desk in the Justice Department that I had an appointment the next day to meet with Jim Baker, the White House chief of staff. I was there for my appointment. He ushered me into his office, closed the door. It was just the two of us. He sat down on his side of the desk, and I was on the other side of the desk. Between us was this stack, a foot and a half high, of seven volumes of laws and regulations that to this day still discriminate against girls and women in this country just because of the accident of their gender of birth. Jim Baker put his hand on the top of this stack of seven volumes, and he looked me in the eye, and with his Texas drawl, I will never forget the moment, he said, "Barbara, I can't imagine a better advocate for American girls and women than you, but I'm sorry to have to tell you that this issue is no longer anything that this president or this vice president want to expend any further financial or political capital on." And that is an exact quote. Well, that hit me in the gut just like a knife. But I realized that I had to accept that decision at that point. So I asked Jim Baker, I thanked him for being honest, and I asked him if I could have the seven volumes back. He said, "Yes, because obviously we don't need them anymore." I took those seven volumes, shook his hand, left his office, which is on the main floor of the West Wing of the White House, not far from the Oval Office. I left his office, and I walked out of the front door of the West Wing of the White House, out of the gate of the White House, and straight down many blocks to the Washington Post, where I walked into the office of Meg Greenfield, the op-ed director and editorial page editor of the Washington Post. She was not there at the time. I left them with a lengthy note, handwritten note, that I got a copy of, a Xerox copy of. I left them for her and let her know what had just happened. Now, as it happened, Meg Greenfield is a feminist, a very passionate feminist. She's now, unfortunately, deceased. But she saw the importance of these volumes. To make a long story short, it wasn't long before the White House senior correspondent, my political godmother, Sarah McClendon, made an appointment for the three of us to get together in Meg Greenfield's office. And that day, Meg Greenfield came out of her inner office into her lobby where Sarah McClendon, the senior White House correspondent, and I were sitting. She brought those seven volumes, put them on the coffee table in front of me, and put her hand on them like Jim Baker had, and she said, "Barbara, do you realize what these are?" And I said, "Well, what do you mean?" And she said, "These are a Richter scale 9, the fact that Jim Baker, the White House chief of staff, has rejected the president's Equal Rights Amendment alternative. You have no idea what this is. It is a political Richter scale 9. She asked me in that meeting to take my time and write up what happened and turn it into her through Sarah McClendon, the senior White House correspondent, which Sarah did, to her as the text, the draft of an op-ed piece for the Washington Post. On August 23, 1983, Meg Greenfield published my op-ed, which is the longest fact-based opinion piece ever published in the Washington Post. It took up the entire page of the Washington Post and has been reprinted in historic documents of 1983 by Congressional Quarterly. You can read it online.
I'm speaking with researcher and author Barbara Honecker. Today's show, We the Men versus We the People. I'm Bonnie Faulkner. This is Guns and Butter.
Now, I won't go into the details of this op-ed, but suffice it to say that it exposed the Reagan-Bush senior administration Justice Department's secret plot, their secret plan, to try to make it far more legally difficult for any American to win any workplace discrimination case under any of the then 56 civil rights laws, including the Civil Rights Act itself, in any court in the United States. My public resignation of conscience and my Washington Post op-ed then triggered an entire week of escalating national and international publicity that only ended with a shoot-down of KAL-007 on September 1st of that year, 1983. What's so important to understand here, Bonnie, is that the Reagan-Bush Senior Justice Department, they had this secret plot to try to destroy the enforcement authority of all the civil rights statutes on the entire books of U.S. federal law by this secret plan that I ended and prevented from succeeding with my op-ed piece in the Washington Post, that their secret plan was going to be an attempt through the courts to reduce the protection under the laws, this equal protection under the laws guaranteed by the 14th Amendment, to reduce that protection for minorities to the same lower level of protection at that time in 1981-82 of American females, because we did not have an Equal Rights Amendment or as strong protections under federal law.
The issue of women's rights, including that of abortion, is headlines today. The Colorado Springs Planned Parenthood Clinic, where three people were killed and nine injured, is being described by the media as a mass shooting. The medical facility had been the scene of protests most weekends. What, in your opinion, is behind the recurring violence at abortion clinics? What politicians at the highest levels of government are most responsible for the rhetoric against women's reproductive rights?
Well, what we just saw in the Colorado Springs Planned Parenthood Clinic shootings is, of course, a major escalation of the war against women's reproductive rights. So this is a serious escalation of the violence. Why is this happening? In my very informed opinion, the extreme religious right in this country, which is the foundation today of the base of the Republican Party, wants to turn what they call the culture war into an outright violent civil war, because violence always favors the right wing. In fact, the entire Republican Party, with fewer and fewer outlier exceptions, are part of this mentality. And their major central issue is to be against abortion rights. In particular, to answer your question about which politicians, Tea Party Libertarian Republicans, former Representatives Ron Paul and his son Senator Rand Paul, and of course the new Republican Speaker of the House, the third person before he has his finger on the nuclear button as Commander-in-Chief under our Constitution and chain of command, and a potential future presidential candidate, Paul Ryan, are the main ones that come to mind. But their position on the abortion issue is phenomenally hypocritical, and they have to know it.
Many of these prominent male libertarian and Tea Party politicians say that the writer Ayn Rand is the inspiration for their political philosophy. Why is this both incredibly ironic and hypocritical?
Well, it's incredibly ironic and hypocritical because Ayn Rand herself was a passionate atheist who explicitly declared in multiple televised interviews that you can see on YouTube that abortion is an absolute moral right. Paul Ryan himself, he's now the Speaker of the House, the Republican Speaker of the House, told the Atlas Society, for instance, which is devoted to promoting Ayn Rand's ideas and philosophy, that Ayn Rand inspired his entire political philosophy. This is an exact quote. If I had to credit one thinker, one person, it would be Ayn Rand, unquote. And Paul Ryan also declared that Ayn Rand's work was required reading for his congressional staff and interns. Now, the current right-wing Tea Party so-called revolution within the libertarian wing of the Republican Party, which is led by Ron Paul, Rand Paul, and Paul Ryan, the new Speaker of the House, is based on Ayn Rand's so-called political philosophy. But they have actually perverted and twisted her actual position on the abortion issue 180 degrees from what she believed. They are really the libertarians and tea parties for liberty, what they call voluntarism, but only for men on this issue, not for women. Rand and Ron Paul and Paul Ryan and the Republican Party in general say they are for smaller government, and they say they are for limiting the reach of the federal government and the state governments, but they are for the government reaching inside women's very bodies, inside their uteruses, inside their wombs, to force pregnancy and childbirth, and are against equal rights for women. There's an outright war on equal rights for women, especially reproductive rights. And yet Ayn Rand herself explicitly supported absolute abortion rights.
Well, let's hear a short clip from Ayn Rand.
Why I support abortion? For the very simple reason that I support individual rights. For the simple reason that neither the state, nor any community, nor yourself have any right to tell a woman what she should do with her life. And also for the reason that an embryo is not alive. And for the reason that one of the most disgusting frauds among many of today's frauds is the idea that the enemies of abortion call themselves defenders of life or pro-life movement or something like that. So that they advocate the rights of the embryo of an unborn entity and refuse to recognize the rights of the living person, the woman.
Do you believe that women's rights, and specifically women's reproductive rights, should be founded on a stronger legal basis than the Supreme Court decision in Roe v. Wade of 1973? And if so, why? And what would that legal basis be?
I would like to say that the answer is not instead of privacy rights, which is the current basis under Roe v. Wade, which needs to be retained as a basis as it is today. But it is vital and urgent that a stronger, morally obvious, and legally permanent foundation be added to the privacy rights foundation already under Roe v. Wade. And that morally obvious, stronger, and more legally permanent foundation would simply be to codify in U.S. federal law the simple principle that it is illegal in the United States to force any organ donation for any purpose.
There is a culture war being fought in the United States over women's rights. How would you describe this culture war, and how dangerous do you feel it is?
There is an urgent need, in fact, to reframe the so-called abortion issue to prevent the right wing in this country from escalating the culture war, which is precisely, in my opinion, what I call the American Taliban Christian fanatics behind this attack inside this time the Colorado Springs abortion clinic actually want. They want to escalate these attacks to inflame and trigger a more violent culture war. On the issue of women's and women's rights, the Republican Party itself has literally become like an American Taliban. They are ideological extremists who are intentionally creating a poisonous environment that feeds domestic terrorism in this country and are trying to ignite a violent culture war on the American homeland. It's important to remember that in the week of 9/11 and since 9/11, the American homeland itself has been officially made into a battlefield command by the Department of Defense, by the Pentagon. This battlefield command is now called NORTHCOM. I am doing this today to prevent that culture war turning violent from happening by exposing the utter and complete hypocrisy and moral bankruptcy of the Republican Party and Tea Partiers' position on the abortion issue, based on my personal experience inside the highest levels of the Reagan White House and Justice Department. There is an extreme and growing danger of basing women's reproductive rights and freedoms on privacy rights, which is the basis in Roe v. Wade. In this post 9/11 massive invasive surveillance state era of 24/7 routine invasions of privacy of all Americans by our government. This is especially urgent with the upcoming 2016 elections, in which we will be electing this time not just the president and members of Congress, but also effectively the majority of the Supreme Court of the United States for the next 2 to 3 decades, given the number of aging progressive justices on the court who will almost certainly retire or resign during this next administration. Given what everyone today now knows, it would be literally, in my opinion, insane to vote for any Republican in this upcoming election. To do so would literally open this nation to becoming an American Taliban-like Christian theocracy, which would also be unconstitutional in the extreme, by the way, as our Constitution explicitly states in its language that there shall, quote, never be any religious test for any office or public trust under the United States or any state, unquote. It is time, finally, for this abortion issue to be fundamentally reframed and revisioned to expose what it is, religious extremists' radical attempt to use the coercive power of the federal and state governments to try to force women to donate the use of their organs, their uterus, on behalf of unborn non-citizen fetuses. This is immoral, it must remain illegal, and it would undercut the very foundation of centuries of both American and British statutory and common law.
I've been speaking with Barbara Honecker. Today's show has been We the Men versus We the People. Barbara Honecker is a leading researcher and author. She is a former senior military affairs journalist at the Naval Postgraduate School. The premier science, technology, and national security affairs graduate research university of the Department of Defense. She held high-level positions in the federal government during the Reagan administration, including White House policy analyst, special assistant to the assistant to the president for domestic policy, and director of the Attorney General's Anti-Discrimination Law Review at the U.S. Department of Justice. Her pioneering book, October Surprise, is the deep story behind the Iran side of the Iran-Contra scandal. Her research into what happened at the nation's military headquarters on September 11th is available in a three-hour video presentation, What Happened at the Pentagon, What Didn't, and Why It Matters, at Amazon.com. Guns and Butter is produced by Bonnie Faulkner, Yaro Mako, and Tony Rango. To leave comments or order copies of shows, email us at faulkner@gunsandbutter.org. That's F-A-U-L-K-N-E-R at G-U-N-S-A-N-D-B-U-T-T-E-R.org. Visit our website at gunsandbutter.org to sign up for our email list and receive our newsletter. Follow us at G&B Radio.
Evolution of the mind. If you seek, then you shall find that we all come from the divine. You dig what I'm saying? Now, if you take heed to the words of wisdom that are written on the walls of life, then universally we will stand, and divided we will fall, because love conquers all. You understand what I'm saying? This is a call to all you sleeping souls. Wake up and take control of your own cipher, and be on the lookout for the spirit sniper trying to steal your life. You know what I'm saying? Look what's inside yourself for peace. Give thanks, live life, and release. You dig me? You got me?
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Welcome to New World News, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, Lance DeHaven Smith speaks with Wit and Wisdom on conspiracy theories, state crimes against democracy, and the get-out-of-jail-free card that every administration official seems to have in his wallet. I hope you'll stay tuned. Probably all of us have some unusual quirk, a quirk that makes you different from the majority of people. To others, if they even know you have it, your quirk may seem like a harmless eccentricity, easily forgiven or overlooked. To you, though, it's not just a preference, it's part of who you are. You feel comfortable when you're among others who share your quirk, and you feel a little edgy when you're surrounded by normal people. Do you know what I mean? I myself have a handful of quirks like this. One of them is, I guess, I'm an intellectual and a scholar at heart. Might as well come out of the closet and acknowledge it. Can't do anything about it. Might as well just accept it. One habit of mind of the scholar and intellectual is judiciousness. I admire that trait a lot. Judiciousness means being very sure that your conclusions are based on reliable evidence, and enough of it. Judiciousness also means getting very clear in your own mind about what you know for certain, and what you conclude is probably true, but you don't know for certain, and what is hypothesis or speculation. These are important distinctions. The propagandists who shape public opinion don't want you to think judiciously. They want you to believe what they tell you and then act accordingly without further thought. That's why America needs scholars and intellectuals. So I was excited to discover a new voice, a scholar I had never heard of, and an interesting one. He is Lance DeHaven Smith. That's hyphenated DeHaven Smith. He's professor of public administration and policy at Florida State University, and he is the author of the scholarly book Conspiracy Theory in America, published in 2013. DeHaven Smith says it is he who invented the term SCADS, which stands for State Crimes Against Democracy. SCADS. He argues that a SCAD is a more useful concept than the pejorative term conspiracy theory. In fact, the term conspiracy theory was introduced into mainstream usage by the CIA itself. This was a smear designed to discredit citizens who were looking closely into the JFK assassination. This week and next, we'll hear DeHaven Smith talk about the concept of SCADs, State Crimes Against Democracy. And he'll discuss some actual proven SCADs, such as candidate Richard Nixon's treasonous subversion of the Paris peace talks in 1968, and the Watergate affair. Also, the U.S. invasion of Iraq. And, here the speaker again is being judicious, he'll talk about events that look like they were probably SCADs, but we don't yet have enough evidence to be certain. These include the JFK assassination and at least some of the events of 9/11 2001. speaking in Denver in September 2013, speaking of SCADs and conspiracy theories, here is Lance DeHaven-Smith.
I thought there would be investigations after the 2000 election and that the crimes that were committed would be prosecuted or at least made known. And what happened instead was people were told, just move on, get over it. You know, there was an investigation, but it was set up so that it said the inquiry was about the technology, and it wasn't about the partisanship in the election administration. Have you seen this movie, Recount? It goes over, well, they're actual crimes that are displayed in the movie, but you don't know they're crimes unless you know the law. On the morning after the election, after Election Day, the general counsel, the lawyer in Governor Jeb Bush's office, called the five largest law firms in Florida and told them that the governor didn't want them working for Al Gore. And they didn't work for him. He had to hire an attorney from out of state. They got boys. This is reported in the movie. It's just kind of a matter-of-fact thing. But the reality was that was a felony. That was use of public office for coercion. They were threatening these law firms with loss of business if they took on Gore's case. Well, there were many crimes like that committed during the 2000 election, and nothing was done. And even the movie Recount, you know, it shows James Baker. He comes across as this real tough guy who's, you know, really competent. And Warren Christopher, the leader of the Democratic, of Gore's campaign, comes across as this wimp who gets, you know, pushed around by Baker. The reality was Warren Christopher was following the law. He was doing what the law said. He wanted to do the right thing, and Baker was abusing the law. So it was very frustrating seeing this. And I wrote a book about the 2000 election and specified the crimes that were committed. It was published by the University Press of Florida, an academic book. Got relatively little attention, but it laid the facts were there. But when I saw that nothing was going to happen about it, I started studying this topic. And I came up with this term, state crimes against democracy. I have a definition for it. Concerted actions or inactions by government insiders intended to manipulate democratic processes and undermine popular sovereignty. It's a terribly turgid definition. The way I developed it was I did a list of what these suspicious events are. There's some that we know there's no dispute about, the Watergate break-in, the crimes of Watergate, the Iran-Contra scandal, the outing of Valerie Plame, the lying us into war in Iraq. This is all documented. So we know that there are these high crimes to subvert democratic processes. But I did a list that included others that we suspect that. The Kennedy assassination, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Robert Kennedy, George Wallace, the attempt on his life, the attempt on Ronald Reagan's life. The 1968 October surprise. I'll tell you about what these are. But anyway, it was a long list. It was like 20-something events, about a third of which were well-confirmed and others we were suspicious about. And I extrapolated from that list to come up with this definition. The basic idea was to have a name for the type of crime that the term conspiracy theory discourages us from speaking about. If we can't name the crime, it's very hard to discuss it. I say actions or inactions when there's a stand down like there was on 9/11 appears to be, where people don't defend the country. That's a SCAD. That's a crime in itself. It's a treason, a form of treason. The Vietnam War was started on a false pretense. The Gulf of Tonkin Resolution was passed. We had our gunships off the islands of North Vietnam, and we were firing on these islands, large cannon fire. And then when the North Vietnamese would come out, we would race back to international waters. Our ships reported they were attacked in the summer of 1964, and they said that they were doing nothing. They were in international waters minding their own business. And so the administration lied to Congress and got that war started when it was really a provocation or a kind of an inaction. I use government insiders because it doesn't always, It isn't always the case that it's somebody in government. It can be a political insider. I'm thinking about Nixon. Nixon, in 1968, was running for president, and there were peace talks going on between North Vietnam, South Vietnam, and the United States. And Nixon thought if they made peace, that he would not win the election, that Hubert Humphrey, the Democratic candidate, would win the election. And so he sent word to North Vietnam, to their president, saying, withdraw from the peace talks, and I'll get you a better deal. That's a treason. I mean, what the man did was treason. The reason we know about this is because Lyndon Johnson, we have a taped telephone call between Lyndon Johnson and Everett Dirksen, a U.S. senator, Republican leader at the time. And Lyndon Johnson knew that Nixon had done this because he had wiretapped Nixon's plane, his campaign plane. Yeah, I mean, these guys, I mean, they do all this stuff. I mean, Mission Impossible, you know, I mean, this is what these people do. This came out in 1997, and Johnson is talking to Dirksen, and he says, I can't believe he's done this. He sabotaged the peace talks. This is treason, but I'm not going to tell the American people because it would destroy their faith in their leaders and their country. So we learn about this in 1997. It's in the news one day. You know, and this is these events, they eventually become known, and we understand the dynamics of them and who was involved. But it's often long after the event. It receives very little attention, and there's no effort to go back and rewrite history with the awareness of this. But anyway, the point was Nixon was not in office, but he was a political insider, and he was doing this as an anti-democratic high crime. I've written a number of articles about this. I won't belabor this much, but I wanted you to know I first wrote about it and defined the state crimes against democracy concept or construct in 2006. And I started working with this guy, Matthew T. Witt. He's a professor at Laverne University in California. And I have to tell you, when you accept that John Kennedy was assassinated by the government, and the evidence is very strong for that, at the very least, the government covered up that it was a conspiracy. There's no doubt about that whatsoever. And once you come to understand that, you should rethink how you think about American government. From then on, you should say, well, you know, these guys are capable of some pretty outlandish things. But my tendency was I would admit this about Kennedy. I would admit Watergate. Everybody knows Watergate. I think we tend to minimize it. Watergate is called the Watergate burglary. It was actually a wiretapping. And the people who were arrested were going back in to the National Democratic Party headquarters. They had wiretapped it 3 weeks prior. And they had transcripts and they were reading them. But one of the wiretaps went out. So they were going back into the National Democratic Party headquarters to replace that wiretap, and they got arrested. The two principals, Howard Hunt and G. Gordon Liddy, worked for the White House and were consultants for the Committee to Reelect the President. They had planned to kill Jack Anderson, an investigative reporter, and Teddy Kennedy, and they had monitored Teddy Kennedy's activities. But the plan was called off. There are many other things. I mean, when the guys were arrested, Howard Hunt sent his wife, Dorothy Hunt, to the White House to tell the White House, look, all of these people that have been arrested in Watergate have obligations. We have mortgages to pay. We have kids in college. We expect our expenses to be covered. They said, if you're in the CIA and you're arrested overseas, they take care of your family. And they felt like they were working for the president. They thought it was a legitimate operation, and they should be covered. Nixon referred to it as hush money. He understood it was blackmail. And John Dean speaks about Dorothy Hunt and says that she was just a completely savvy person, that she was, you know, wife of a CIA agent and had gone all over the world, and she had been a CIA agent in France before she married Howard Hunt. Well, Dorothy gets several hundred thousand dollars for the Watergate burglars, as they call it. They call the Watergate burglars because the day after it happened, the press secretary of President Nixon said, this is a third-rate burglary attempt. We had nothing to do with it. It's just a screw up by these overzealous campaigners. And we call it a burglary to this day when it was espionage at the highest level, you know, attacking the opposition Democratic Party during a presidential election. What I wanted to tell you about Dorothy Hunt, though, was she was on a plane flight to Chicago with $10,000 in cash to disperse, and her plane crashed, and she was killed. There was a grand jury impaneled in Chicago, and they brought Robert Haldeman in to testify because they thought it had been that he had killed her, that the Nixon people had killed her. There was no evidence, and all they did was make him testify, and then they let him go. We know this in part because Haldeman tells this to Nixon in the White House, and we have it on the White House tapes. But the point is, Watergate was more than a burglary. I mean, we're talking about a crime spree of fairly wide proportions. The break-in to Howard Hunt's psychiatrist office, Ellsberg's psychiatrist office, there were 100 break-ins like that around Washington at that time, where the people's psychiatrists had their files rifled when they were providing service, psychoanalytic services to very important people's wives or husbands. So Watergate was, you know, this massive crime spree. Witt got me thinking about it in those terms. You know, I would say, well, you know, Nixon was crazy. I thought of Nixon as a, I mean, I think most of us do think about him as, you know, he was paranoid and nuts and a gangster. It took me a while to get used to the idea that a lot of them are like that. It's not just him, you know? So he helped me with that. We wrote an article in 2010 that was published in the American Behavioral Scientist, which is a fairly widely read journal. And there was an op-ed that was written by Mickey Huff, some guys at Project Censored. They said that they wrote about this study and they submitted it to an online website that they had published other things in, and they were told they would not publish this because it was on conspiracy theory. And they were stunned. I mean, they said, this is what we do. We publicize things that are being stifled, and we had this outlet, and they told us that we couldn't publish on that. But I don't think many people would have read it if these guys hadn't publicized it. I wrote an article on the Nuremberg War Crimes trials, and this was kind of shocking to me to go back and read about this. I was teaching a class on international conflict and international law. So I read the Constitution, I read the UN Charter, and I read the War Powers Resolution of 1973 and the 2001 authorization to use military force against the people who planned 9/11 and the 2002. And what I found was we break the law all the time. Okay? I mean, when we threaten Syria, that's a violation of the UN Charter. We are signatories to the UN Charter. Our Constitution says our treaties are the highest law of the land. They're higher than the law. They're higher than the Constitution. And that treaty says we're not going to invade people unless we're being attacked. And we have to get a resolution from the United Nations to continue, even if we're attacked. We have to get their support to continue it. But we violate it all the time. Well, I went back. I said, you know, let's look at the Nuremberg War Crimes trials. And to my surprise, what I found was that the first charge in the indictment of the Nazi war criminals was a conspiracy charge. They had conspired to overthrow the parliamentary government in Germany and then warmonger and strike fear into people's hearts and then start an aggressive war against other countries. Do you know what we did to these people? We hung them. They included not only politicians, they included diplomats who were fronting for the Nazi war of aggression. They included journalists who were warmongers and anti-Semites. They included lawyers. We prosecuted these criminal cases because after the war, Stalin said, let's kill all the officers in the Nazi army. And Churchill said, no, we can't do that. Let's kill 20,000 of them. I know it's kind of glib, but that's really what they said. And The Americans said, no, we have to teach a lesson to the German people. We have to show them what their leaders did, and we have to show them that they have a responsibility as citizens in an elected representative democracy to not let power be consolidated and to never let this happen again. The Germans have learned that lesson pretty well. I mean, they're very cautious about what they do in foreign policy. So what I did in this article was simply compare what the Bush-Cheney administration did in terms of twisting the intelligence and telling people that we were going to be potentially that this country was trying to build nuclear bombs and had weapons of mass destruction and they could give them to terrorists and we were in peril, when they knew otherwise. They knew otherwise. The torture that we talk about? The torture occurred in August of 2002 at Guantanamo Bay. There were two people tortured, and they were waterboarded like 186 times. I mean, it was a horrendous thing. But what they were doing was trying to get confessions linking 9/11 to the country of Iraq. And once they couldn't get that, they stopped it. There was Abu Ghraib and all that. That was different. This was torture that came right out of the White House. So anyway, I did this article and said, if you look at what the Bush-Cheney administration did and you compare it to our charges against the Nazis at Nuremberg, you'll find they're parallel, almost exactly, bang, bang, bang. I could not get that published in the United States. I had it reviewed at one journal three times, and the reviewers kept saying, this is a great article. This is an important article. We cannot publish it. Literally, I'd never seen anything like this. I submitted it to Contemporary Politics, was the name of the journal, and they published it right away. It's published in London. It's a British journal. It taught me a lesson about what we're up against. Science is supposed to be a search for the truth. It's not an organ of legitimation for the power structure in America, but that's pretty much what it appears to be because it was too controversial. But the reason I tell you about it is you're probably not aware of the academic background on it. And there's a pretty good body of research now that establishes that there are these kinds of crimes. They need to be looked at comparatively and collectively together so you see patterns in them. And that you can't depend on the government to – there are a number of reasons I'll go over why we can't depend on the government to – give us the truth. There's a book from Paul Gray Macmillan on state crimes against democracy. That's the title of the book. So the term's getting out. That just came out about 3 months ago. I won't belabor this, but I just want to point out that SCAD is not a conspiracy theory. It's not a term for that. It's a term for the crime. We wouldn't say white-collar conspiracy, you know, or white-collar theory. We would say white-collar crime. And it's the same way with state crimes. You have to think in terms of crimes, not theories of crimes. I think you all know that it's a pejorative term. The problems with the term conspiracy theory, it's a totally nonsensical term. The way it's used is anything that is suspicious of government insiders conspiring to subvert democratic processes is considered ludicrous, paranoid. Well, it's nonsensical because we know conspiracies happen. We had Watergate. We had Iran-Contra. We had Plangate. We know conspiracies happen. So it's crazy to say any suspicion of conspiracy has got to be ludicrous. It's quite the opposite. You should be carefully discerning what are reasonable suspicions and what are not. The conspiracy theory label lumps everything together. From aliens taking over the planet to who assassinated Kennedy. And you lump them all together and then take the most ludicrous example and equate all other suspicions with that. That's not reasonable. That's unreasonable. Conspiracy theory label is un-American. The Declaration of Independence is a conspiracy theory. I urge you to read it. The first part of the Declaration is about inalienable rights, but then it goes on to list a set of crimes that King George committed or was suspected of committing that were intended together to deprive the colonists of their rights as British citizens. And they said they suspected that King was trying to gain tyranny over them and that gave them the right. Not any of the crimes individually, but what they suspected about his motives. So people who say conspiracy theory is ludicrous forget that America was founded on a conspiracy theory. when people use the term conspiracy theory, what they're forcing on you, in addition to shutting you up and saying that you're crazy, what they're suggesting is that the official account of these events is solid, strong evidence, and what you've got is speculation and, you know, at the very least, dubious. But in reality, if you look at the official accounts of things like the Kennedy assassination or 9/11, basically they are coincidence theories. They're troubling patterns that on their face look suspicious, and they're dismissed as coincidences. When you talk about 9/11 to somebody, or the anthrax letter attacks, or the Kennedy assassination, they will tell you that the American government would not commit crimes like this. And furthermore, if they did commit them, they're not competent enough to do it. They couldn't pull it off. And furthermore, if they, by some fluke, they did succeed in doing one of these things, they couldn't keep it quiet. Somebody would talk. So there's this assumption that you couldn't do these things. They're just on its face. I have Daniel Ellsberg's book, Secrets, the cover up there. It's a great book. What he reminds us of is that the Manhattan Project, which involved 100,000 people developing the atomic bomb, was kept secret throughout World War II. Totally secret. Truman, when he became president after FDR died, he did not know about the atomic bomb for a week until they told him. It's kept secret through compartmentalization, the need to know. People are working on it, but they don't know what it is. They're doing this part, they're doing that part, building the casing, you know. So it's quite easy for the government to keep secrets. It does an excellent job of it. It's got a very sophisticated technique for doing it. Ellsberg also points out that people who are privy to these secrets think they are really special, think that they really know what's up. So they don't want to tell anybody. What they do is remain silent. He says they listen to people and they think in their minds, if this person knew what I knew, they wouldn't be saying what they're saying. They consider everybody else really just foolish and out of the loop. And the last problem with the conspiracy theory label is that people who use it attack individuals. They attack individuals who say that John Kennedy was killed by more than one shooter, or 9/11 was a controlled demolition of the buildings. They attack individuals, but they never talk about the conspiracy theories of the institutions, of the government itself. The conspiracy theory of Iraq trying to get nuclear weapons. Now, that was a dangerous conspiracy theory. That was a conspiracy theory that cost 100,000 lives and thousands of our soldiers. That was a dangerous conspiracy. Does anybody say, oh, that's a conspiracy theory, you shouldn't say that? No, no. So it's really a terrible term.
Lance DeHaven-Smith, speaking on what's wrong with the term conspiracy theory, and, more importantly, what's wrong with the government itself committing major crimes to further its own ends. That was part one. More of this interesting talk next week. Our thanks to Robin Upton of Unwelcome Guests for supplying and editing the original recording. I have edited it some more myself. UnwelcomeGuests.net. That's them. And NewWorldNotes.blogspot.com. That's us. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust, thanking you for listening, advising illegitimate non carborundum, and hoping you'll tune in again next week. Ciao. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, 9/11 wake up.
Hello, listeners, and welcome to this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. The show you're about to hear today originally aired in the fall of 2014. Today you'll hear the second part of an interview with author Stephen Lendman on 9/11 as the mother of all big lies and the state of America and the world in its aftermath. Stephen Lendman is a writer, syndicated columnist, activist, news TV personality, and radio show host. He currently writes for MoneyNewsNow.com and VeteransToday.com and hosts a progressive radio show at the Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. He's also author of the celebrated books Banker Occupation, Waging Financial War on Humanity, and How Wall Street Fleeces America, Privatized Banking, Government Collusion, and Class War, and just recently a new book called Flashpoint in Ukraine, which is a compilation of 22 geopolitical analysts countering the fraudulent Western narrative on Ukraine and why it matters so much. So here's part two of that interview.
Let's jump to your new book, The Flashpoint in the Ukraine.
The book is a very important book, and most Americans, I would say, know nothing about the Ukraine story. I wanted to write something about Ukraine, and I wrote many articles about it while the crisis was developing and getting very, very, very severe. And I've written three other books. I asked my editor at Clarity Press whether she was planning to do a book on Ukraine, and she jumped on the idea and she asked me if I would edit it. The book was made possible by 21 other contributors, marvelous people who contributed marvelous content to the book and gave the book the kind of key information that everybody has to know to understand what the Ukraine story is all about. The Ukraine story is really using Ukraine as a pretext, and Russia is the target. Washington wants all former Soviet republics and all former Warsaw Pact countries made part of NATO. It wants U.S. bases on Russia's borders. It wants long-range nuclear missiles targeting Russia's heartland. It wants Russia surrounded by U.S. bases. It wants to transform Russia the same way it wants to transform all the other independent countries. Russia is independent. It's very proudly independent. America wants it made a pro-Western vassal state. Putin is the hero of the Ukraine story. Obama and other U.S. officials are the enemy, the ghost of the 9/11 story. And this has to be turned around. But the propaganda is vicious. It goes on round the clock. It's every day. Putin is bashed. Russia is bashed. Big lies are told. Russia did not invade Ukraine. Russia did not annex Crimea. The Crimeans, by a vote, I still remember the percentage, Cheryl, Crimeans, by a vote of 96.7% with an 82% turnout, voted to join Russia. They were part of Russia until 1954, and they were for about 200 years. They wanted to go back again. Crimeans put it this way, we want to go home, and indeed they did go home. And the Russian parliament and Putin merely acknowledged their wishes and went along with them. But to refer to it as an annexation, which implies illegality, is another big lie. So if the war began, well, the biggest story about Ukraine, Ukraine did not have the kind of government I would certainly approve of, extremely corrupt, the Yanukovych government, Viktor Yanukovych. But it was democratically elected. It was elected years earlier. America staged an Orange Revolution in 2004, I believe, ousted the Yanukovych government. It was reelected in 2010. America wanted Yanukovych removed because he wouldn't go along with America's plan to have Ukraine turn west instead of east, to become part of the EU, which was really raping and pillaging Ukraine. Yanukovych initially agreed to do it, and then he changed his mind. He did it for very logical reasons. There were wrinkles thrown into the deal, things that weren't brought up initially when he agreed to become part of it. He was targeted for that reason. Get rid of this guy, get other people to take his place. And the scheme was get rid of a Democrat, put fascists in his place, infested with neo-Nazis. And that's exactly what happened. Neo-Nazi infested fascists replacing a democratic government. They took over. They usurped power. They have no legitimacy whatsoever. They're running Ukraine. They launched war against the Democrats in southeastern Ukraine, in Donetsk, in Lugansk, in other cities. They wanted these people removed. They've been murdering them. They've been killing civilians. And this has been going on since April. So this is the scheme that's been going on. Get rid of these people. Institute hardline rule across the country and make Ukraine one hardline rule country, no local autonomy, no democratic governments, fascist governments. Well, the people of southeast Ukraine simply won't tolerate this, and they fought back, and indeed they did valiantly to the point where they have the upper hand now. There is a peace deal that's signed. Will it hold? I don't think so, Cheryl. I think it'll be violated. There are violations right now. They're sporadic, but I think there'll be more serious violations. And America's war of state terror will continue with its stooge government in Kiev waging its war for it. And the war will resume once the Ukrainian forces regroup and decide they have the weapons to go after these people again to be able to continue the war. They couldn't. They were getting beaten very, very badly. And I believe they stopped the campaign to regroup and hope that they could come back and be able to fight more effectively than they did so far. The supposed weapons that the Ukrainians have, weapons not that Russia supplied them with, but weapons that were left by Russian forces as they decided they wanted no part of this thing anymore. They left, they deserted, they either went home or they went back to Russia, and they left their weapons behind them.
Yeah, and it seems to me that Putin has done, and the Russians have done a really good job of trying to avoid war, but it seems like the U.S. and NATO are really provoking them.
Does our government want a major war with Russia?
It's incredible that anybody in this country would think that way. A major war with Russia comes down to this: nuclear war. I've written about the father of the nuclear navy, Hyman Rickover, in the 1980s. He had very second thoughts about nuclear weapons. In the 1980s, he testified before Congress, and he said to the effect that in any future wars, combatants to win will use any weapons they have. They won't use weapons like nuclear weapons they don't have to use. But to win the war, if it takes using nuclear weapons, they will use them. And Rickover was warning Congress, if there's a war with Russia, it'll be a nuclear war. And if it's a nuclear war, you could say it'll come down to this. World War I was supposed to be the war to end all wars. If there's a nuclear war, it will be the war to end all wars. There won't be another war. Bertrand Russell said, you can either have war or you can have the end of humanity. Albert Einstein said he didn't know what weapons would be used in World War III, but in World War IV, it would be sticks and stones. This is the danger we face.
And it seems like we're really out there provoking it. It's really shocking to me. I also wanted to ask you if you could comment on the sanctions that Obama and the NATO countries have just imposed on Russia.
The sanctions are very counterproductive. They may end up, ironically, doing Russia more good than harm, Cheryl. It's incredible. Let me explain what I mean by that. The EU stands to be hurt the most by imposing sanctions. They have a great deal of trade with Russia, hundreds of billions of dollars, $400 billion, $500 billion. They've already sacrificed a lot of their agricultural trade. If they sacrifice a lot of their important trade with Russia, then they will take a big, big hit. So they don't want to do this. European industry absolutely wants nothing to do with this, but American pressure is getting European countries to go along, and indeed they are. But what is Russia doing in response? We haven't seen Russia's later response. We will before too long. But Russia is turning east as opposed to west. It struck a tremendous deal with China, an immense energy deal. I wrote a major article about it where Russia has an energy deal involving oil and gas that involves hundreds of billions of dollars. It's an incredible deal for both countries. They both benefit greatly. and what may happen in the wake of a deal like this. Well, what already has happened is Russia will expand its non-energy trade with China, its defense trade, its technology trade, its trade in other products and services, and this can only grow. And other countries are turning to Russia to trade with, especially South American ones, Asian ones. So Russia is getting less dependent on European trade. It's relying more on other parts of the world. And in the end, it may benefit. And in the end, America and European countries may end up losers.
Now, on the Clarity Press website, it describes your book as
22 political analysts counter the fraudulent Western narrative on Ukraine and why it matters so much. And some of these 22 include Michael Parenti, Cynthia McKinney, John McMurtry, James Petras, Paul Craig Roberts, Mahdi Darius, Nazim Roya, and the list goes on with more various writers and thinkers. Can you let the listeners know where they could pick up a copy of this book?
Oh, it's very simple to do. They could either go to Clarity's website, or a simple way to do it would be to go to Amazon. And I'm also told that Barnes & Noble carries the book. I was really thrilled to be able to be involved in the project. I wrote so much about Ukraine, Cheryl, as the conflict was materializing. It began in November 2013, the violence that was instigated in the Maidan Independence Square in Ukraine. And again, this was instigated by the fascists that were trained in countries like Lithuania, like Latvia, like Poland, and then they were brought back into Ukraine. The killings that were done in the Maidan were done by these people. They were armed. They were trained to kill. They killed ordinary Ukrainians. They killed Ukrainian police. The Ukrainian police responded one day violently to the protests that broke out in November. And Yanukovych, for all his faults, came down extremely hard on his police forces and demanded no more of this, and there was no more of this. They stopped it. They really overreacted. And where they should have put down the violence, they just held back. They held back too much. The violence continued. It got extremely heavy, and ordinary people were killed. Police were killed. The coup happened on the 22nd of February. Yanukovych was ousted. The fascists were elevated. They have no legitimacy whatsoever, but they're in power. A so-called chocolate king, Petro Poroshenko, is the new president of Ukraine. He has no legitimacy. He's a billionaire crook. He runs the country. You've got an illegitimate prime minister. Try to remember all of these names. Arseniy Yatsenyuk is the illegitimate prime minister. He's one of the proliferators of big lies. And again, they go on and on, Cheryl, one big lie after another. So the Ukrainian people have no idea what's going on. These lies are repeated in the U.S. media. Americans have no idea what's going on. But the truth is polar opposite to big lies that are repeated over and over again. And it doesn't matter whether you read the New York Times or you watch Fox News, you get the same rubbish. The only difference is the Times is a lot more sophisticated and smooth than Fox News, just the way BBC is.
Jumping back now to Syria again and the situation there in Syria and Iraq, my understanding is that the Syrians were winning the battle against the rebels that were being supported by the U.S. and Saudi Arabia and other countries in the Middle East. And maybe you can speak to that for a moment, and then where do you see it going in Syria from here?
Yeah, I think it took the Syrians a while, Cheryl, but they really were winning the battle. How can insurgents on the ground go up against a military which certainly is not omnipotent, but it has heavy weapons, it has fighter aircraft, it has tanks, it has artillery? How can ordinary terrorist fighters with mostly small arms go up against a fighting force like this and prevail? It's impossible, and of course they couldn't do it. So the Syrians really were prevailing, and they're prevailing now. The story, though, is that even though Syria is prevailing, new fighters are coming in all the time. You've got these people being imported from dozens of countries. They're coming in. They're targeting ordinary Syrians. They're going after civilians. They're going after civilian communities. And they're really causing a great amount of mischief in the country, blowing up buildings, sending off car bombs, just mass murder and destruction. And this is what's going on. So you've got terrible carnage going on. And I've written so many articles about both Syria and Ukraine, the horrors that are going on in these countries. Well, they're going on. It'll get worse, if America becomes Syria's air force. And if Obama attacks Syria, and it absolutely looks like he will, then we're talking about America declaring war on an independent country that does not threaten America. It's illegal act of aggression. Anybody can read the law, Cheryl. Anybody can read it and understand exactly what it says and exactly what it means. What George Bush did in Afghanistan, in Iraq, what Obama did in Libya and in Syria, and plans to do directly against Syria, constitutes illegal aggression against countries that don't threaten America. And these are cold, hard facts. And anybody reading international law can understand it perfectly. It's in plain English, very clear, illegal aggression. And what it says is this: no country may interfere in the internal affairs of another for any reason except self-defense. No country can attack another country for any reason except in self-defense. It can attack if it's being attacked, but even then, it can only attack until the Security Council responds. It alone has final authority on whether one country can attack another. Not U.S. presidents, Cheryl, not the Congress, not other U.S. officials, not the Pentagon, nobody except the U.N. Security Council. And the way the council is structured, if one country vetoes what the others want, the resolution goes down. And I can assure you, Russia, and I would imagine China, will not permit America to attack Syria.
So basically then, the Bush administration, Bush and the people around him, and the Obama administration and the people around him who are supporting these attacks really are war criminals.
Oh, absolutely, they're war criminals. They're war criminals multiple times over. You attack another country that does not pose a threat to yourself, you are committing a war crime. You're committing crimes against humanity. And that is very clear. That is an absolute fact. And there isn't any legitimate lawyer in the country, Cheryl, that can dispute that, because it's all there in black and white.
So we were losing the battle in Syria because the rebels that we put in, they were failing. The Assad administration over there, the government was winning. Is ISIS now our creation and we're using it as an excuse so that we can attack Syria, claiming we're going after ISIS, but we really want to, will we really start attacking the Assad government?
Yeah, that's the deal. That's the deal. I wrote one article and I began it saying, ISIS is the pretext, Syria is the target, a regime change is the objective. I mean, that really sums it up in three short statements.
Let's talk about the beheadings a little bit, because
yes.
I read somewhere, maybe it was Press TV, I saw that actually they were saying that the Foley, the first person to be beheaded, was actually killed a year ago.
Yes, I read that.
And I'm wondering, are those legitimate news stories or are those more lies?
Oh, I think there's a very strong possibility that they are legitimate, because these events are always strategically timed, Cheryl. You never see these events happen out of context to something else that may be going on. You may remember, and your listeners may remember, last August, the so-called Syrian chemical weapons attack in Ghouta, a suburb of Syria. Well, the Syrian government had nothing to do with the Ghouta attack. The Ghouta attack was staged by the rogue elements coming into Syria. The same kind of, whether it was ISIL, whether it was Al-Qaeda, whether it was al-Nusra, there isn't one documented case of Syria conducting a chemical weapons attack against its own people. Not one verifiable documentable case. There are a lot of cases that have been lied about, but Syria had nothing to do with any of them. It was these rebel groups, these terrorists imported from other countries that came in and conducted the attacks. And the so-called Ghouta attack was the most important one of all. The numbers varied. America said 500. France had a much different number, much lower. Britain had a much lower number. Who knows what the real number was? It was probably in the dozens or maybe 100. But it had nothing to do with the Syrian government. But again, these attacks were strategic to give America a pretext to go to war against Syria. And the idea was for Obama to do it then. But the American public was so outraged and protested so loudly in emails, in phone calls, in protests in front of congressional offices, 100-1 against doing it, 200-1, 300-1, Republican congressmen and senators just like Democrat ones. And Obama was simply called down. He couldn't do what he wanted to do. At the time I wrote, Obama's war on Syria was postponed. It was not canceled.
So where is ISIS being trained?
ISIS is trained in Jordan. ISIS forces are brought in from dozens of countries. You're trained in Jordan by U.S. Special Forces and by CIA agents. FBI operatives may be there as well. This is standard practice. The New York Times, several years ago, reported about terrorist elements being trained in Jordan. And I forget the name of the groups that they gave them, but terrorist groups being imported into Jordan and CIA operatives training them. The New York Times reported this. Mm-hmm. So this is exactly what's going on with ISIS. You've got these elements coming in. You've got special forces involved, CIA, FBI, same dirty deal all over again. So America can wage another imperial war.
So the beheadings were either real or fake, but were done at this point in time to drum up American support to get rid of these horrible people.
Exactly. Look at the support that happened post 9/11. The day before 9/11, Bush had about a 50% approval rating. On the day of 9/11, it shot up to 90%, Cheryl. I remember it vividly. And of course, he went out of office, one of the lowest approval ratings of any U.S. president. It was down around the level of Harry Truman during the Korean War. And Richard Nixon had an abysmal approval rating. But the idea was to turn the American public around, get them on board for America's imperial agenda. And that's the scheme. You've got to get the American public mad. You've got to make them believe that the beheadings of Foley or anybody else is just cause to wage war against a non-belligerent country. And very sadly, Cheryl, most people lap it up where they should absolutely denounce it and want nothing to do with it. But again, these events are very strategically timed. My guess is these beheadings absolutely were timed at this point. And the latest one, the British subject who was beheaded, last summer, Britain's Parliament voted against joining America's coalition to wage war on Syria. Well, David Cameron is now Prime Minister of Britain, is apoplectic, just arousing the British public to get involved in America's war. We'll see whether it succeeds or not. But he wants to get in America's war, even though he knows that the British Parliament voted against it last summer. I think Britain will join the coalition. We'll see what the Arab states do. There's a report in the New York Times today that says Arab states will join the American coalition. But we'll wait. They can say one thing. They can do another. We'll wait and see what they actually do.
What do you think Russia will do if we start bombing in Syria?
Well, that's a very good question. What will Russia do? The last thing Russia wants is a war with America, and Russia will go all out to avoid it. Since the Ukrainian crisis developed, literally Russia, Vladimir Putin, and Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov have gone overboard to settle the conflict peaceably. Peaceful conflict resolution. If any two leaders deserve the Nobel Peace Prize, they do. Not Obama for waging one imperial war after another, but these men deserve a Nobel Peace Prize for literally going all out for peace. They will do exactly the same thing if there's a Syria war. They've tried to settle the Syrian conflict responsibly. They've been rebuffed every step of the way. And when they vetoed U.S. resolutions, they did it to avoid war, Cheryl. They didn't to let Syria keep murdering its people. Syria is not murdering its people. Syria is protecting its people. Syria, Bashar al-Assad, is doing what any responsible leader would do to protect his people against foreign invaders. And that's exactly what's going on. The opposition in Syria is mainly nonviolent. The opposition against him outside of the country being imported is mainly violent, but you'll never find that out in the U.S. media.
Where would you recommend people go to find out what's really happening rather than listening to the mainstream media, the corporate media?
There are lots of good independent websites. If I could pick one that I would recommend very strongly, it would be Global Research. Global Research is a marvelous website. Daily, it publishes a lot of my articles, but daily, it publishes important information on the major world and national events that tell people exactly what they need to know so they can defend themselves against the big lie, the big lies, and know when these things are proliferated in the U.S. media, they know what's going on, they can spread the word to other people, and this is exactly what they need to do. I hope they will, because if they do, we can avoid the horrors going on now, and we literally have a chance for peace and getting away for one imperial war after another. And I would highlight there hasn't been a single day during Obama's tenure, one term and over a year and a half into the second, there hasn't been one day of peace. it have been only days of war, perpetual war, one war after another.
So we've been lied to about 9/11, about the war in Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, Syria. What can the American people do other than, as you just said, educating yourselves, try and find sources of news that are going to be truthful and turn off CNN and Fox News and all the others that are lying to you? But I know this is a tough question, but can you think of anything else that we can do to resist this and keep our country from becoming a tyranny and also from keeping our leaders from killing people around the world?
Well, I remember quoting what Benjamin Franklin said one time in the forming of the Republic way back, where he was only an observer, he wasn't a participant because he was an old man at the time. And somebody apparently asked him what he thought about the formation of the new Republic. And he said, well, you know, it's wonderful if you can keep it.
If you can keep it.
And his implication was that things may start out marvelously, but in the end, the dark forces are going to come in. They'll be deeply corrupt. And the supposed democracy that was formed will go down the drain, and Americans will lose everything they thought they had. And this is exactly what happened. I would even go further than Ben Franklin and say the Republic was never democratic. It was never formed to be a democracy. It was formed, in the words of John Jay, America's first Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. The Republic was formed to let people who own the country run it. It was true from George Washington, who the founders wanted to anoint as a king. He decided wisely not to take the job. Two terms was enough, and he was out. But this was a scheme from the beginning, but it only got worse in the succeeding years. Well, you can bet your share you and I would take Washington or Jefferson or Madison or Lincoln any day in place of Obama or George Bush or Dick Cheney or people like that. But that's what we're stuck with. The only way to get around these people is to get good information, go to independent websites, listen to broadcasts like this one, listen to my program, the Progressive Radio News Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. It is so easy these days to get accurate information. I said in an email to you, Cheryl, when I grew up in the 40s and 50s, there was only radio, there was no television, there was no internet. It was tough to get good information. You had to dig it out on your own, and it wasn't easy. And I did spend a lot of time doing it, but now it is so easy. I would say to people, if you spend 15 minutes a day looking for solid information on the big issues of the day, you can find it easily, you can know what's going on, you'll know the big lies when you hear them, you'll debunk them, you can spread the truth to other people, and you can help keep America safe. But if you won't do this, you literally risk letting full-blown tyranny take over this country and ending what semblance of democracy there may be left. There's not a lot, but the little that is left will go down the drain because ordinary people simply won't do what they should do. And this is my great fear. I can only hope that people will act this way responsibly. Again, this is so vital to do. There's a marvelous quote from I.F. Stone, the great muckraking journalist of the 1960s, or going back to the 1940s, 1950s, 1960s, he urged people to get involved in things like this, and he said, the only campaigns people should wage are the ones they know they'll lose. Because if they keep waging them, and if they pass the baton to others, and if they lose them, and if they pass the baton to still others, then one day, because of the work that they did, somebody will win. And America can be the kind of nation that we want it to be. It's a marvelous quote.
Powerful.
His most famous quote was, all politicians lie, and nothing they say should be believed.
Yeah, that one seems pretty accurate. We're just about out of time. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that you'd like to share with our listeners?
I would just say if Americans don't get on track to literally making this country into the kind of nation we want it to be, then the only thing we can expect ahead is a tyrannical nation, because this is the way they all happen in the end. Good things just seem to disintegrate. The Soviet Union began with high ideals, much higher ideals than what developed. And the things that the people who instituted the Soviet Union wanted to put in place simply never happened. And instead, the people of Russia got tyranny, and they got Stalin instead of democracy. I think that sums it up very well. Well, the only way to prevent that is for ordinary people to get into the fight and decide they simply will not tolerate this. They want a country representing everybody. They want equity and justice, and they're willing to put their bodies on the line enough because if they don't do it, they'll be persecuted and they'll never have any of the things that everybody deserves. And very sadly, that's exactly what the case is. It's up to us to institute responsible change, Cheryl. And if we don't do it, nobody will do it for us.
Stephen Lenman, I want to thank you very much for being on the show and sharing your vast knowledge and insight about the world we live in today. And let's do this again sometime.
Cheryl, I enjoyed it very much.
And again, you were just listening to the second and final part of an interview with author Stephen Lenman. This concludes this edition of 9/11 Wake Up Call. I'm Cheryl. Thanks for listening. This is Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.
Later on, the presidential candidates on immigration, exploiting the politics of resentment.
But first,
healthcare justice. Well, we're about to get a home visit from a doctor. Hey, what doctors do home visits anymore? Well, ours does, Dr. Donald E. Moore. And you know, while millions of Americans are scrambling to re-enroll in health insurance programs under the Affordable Care Act, also known as Obamacare, before the January 31st deadline, surely they can't help but be frustrated by the limitations of the private insurance marketplace. Well, our guest, Dr. Donald Moore, while noting the gains made under Obamacare, and there are some, sees its defects play out in his own efforts to provide good medical care to patients. In addition to often increasing out-of-pocket expenses, the insurance companies dictate which specialists he can refer patients to, and he is pressured to shorten patient visits and bill them more. In response, he has gone single payer or advocates Medicare for all, refusing to work with private insurers and now mainly accepting patients under Medicare and Medicaid. He is urging all doctors to join the movement for Medicare for All, single payer, to reform the healthcare system based on inefficient private health care insurance with its high administrative overhead and profits margins. He is joined with other doctors in the Physicians for National Health Program in lobbying the New York State Legislature to institute a single-payer system. We'll find out more about it. And Dr. Donald E. Moore, MD, MPH, past president of the Medical Society of the County of Kings and board member of Physicians for a National Health Plan. It's nice to have you with us. And hey, give us your prescription with this home visit for real preventative care.
Pleasure to join you all. Let me just point out that I make real house calls. 2 days a week, I go out there, and I'm usually all over Brooklyn and sometimes all the way up to the Bronx, where I actually see patients in their homes. And I think it's something that is really needed. We need to do a lot more of it. And I just want to really make a plug for doctors making more house calls.
I was amazed. I'm delighted. And you're invited.
The problem that we have currently is that we have a healthcare system that doesn't really work for anyone except the insurance companies. It doesn't work for the providers. And the providers are not just the doctors. The providers are the hospitals and all the health professionals that earnestly try to provide service to their patients. The healthcare system really doesn't work for the patients either, because as most of you out there in Radioland know, every time you try to access healthcare, whether you go to the hospital, to the ER, to your doctor, you have to shell out some money. It's called generally a copay. Copay is a fixed amount you pay every time you try to get healthcare. Copays are foreign in most other countries. They don't know what a copay is. You go to most of the countries in Europe that have good healthcare systems. You go to Canada, they don't pay copays. And then there's a co-insurance. Your bill is $100. You have to pay 20%. That's how Medicare currently exists. And most other insurances have even higher co-insurances. And, of course, the deductible. That's the worst part. The deductible is the part where before you get any health care, you have to come up with a certain amount of money. Obamacare, or the Affordable Care Act, basically ask those who are uninsured to go to an exchange and get insurance. If you go on that exchange, you will see that the so-called bronze plans, the ones that are affordable to most people, those plans have very, very high deductibles. The deductibles may go as high as $5,000, $6,000 for an individual. For a family, it may be $13,000, $14,000. So it really doesn't create access for the average person. People who have more means to buy better health insurance plans, they don't have those high deductibles. So it's the usual situation. The less you have, the less access you have. So Martin Luther King talked about that injustice in healthcare being amongst the worst injustice that we could perpetrate against each other, injustice in healthcare. Aristotle talked about how a society should and has the ability to provide health to its population. So these are not new concepts. What is terrible, though, is that after all these years of evolution, particularly in America, we haven't figured out how to care for the health of the entire population. Well, my prescription is, why don't we just have Medicare for everybody? Medicare exists. It's not a new concept. Most of us understand it. Medicare currently is the insurance that people over 65 get. We're talking about Medicare that's a little bit better. A Medicare without deductibles, a Medicare without co-insurances, and a Medicare without co-payments. We're talking about an improved Medicare, and we're talking about an expanded Medicare that does not start at 65 years old, but starts from the day you're born. That's not too difficult, because we already have the administrative structure for that. And that structure that we give our population Medicare is much better than what happens when we do it through private insurance companies. It's also much cheaper. The private insurance companies' administrative cost to administer care is about 20% on the average and can get as high as 30%. For each dollar you spend on that premium, when you buy a commercial insurance, 20 to 30 cents of that dollar goes to administrative costs. Yet, when we take our tax dollars and pay for Medicare, only 2 to 3 cents go to the administrative costs. Part of that administrative cost in the commercial insurance line goes to profits. And we know about those profits. We know about the high salaries that the CEOs and top executives of the insurance companies get. We also know about the waste and the duplication that occurs in those commercial insurances. Medicare administers care for a much larger group of people and do it at a much lower cost. And it's done through our tax, which works a lot better than trying to collect premium either through your employer, which is how it's done for the most part in the commercial sector. So my prescription, the prescription of the colleagues that agree with me, those who belong to the Physicians for a National Health Program, is Medicare for all, an improved and expanded Medicare. So that's all prescription. Obamacare was really an inadequate attempt to fix what I see as a broken healthcare delivery. Well, really, a broken healthcare financing system. We have problems with the delivery system, but I think the financing is really where things get messed up. So Obamacare basically was to increase the amount of people who have health insurance. Back in 2010, when the Affordable Care Act was put into law, we had about 15% of the population that was uninsured. Basically, they had no insurance at all. The plan, that was somewhere around 50 million people. The intent of that law was not to insure the whole 50 million, but to insure about 30 million. And most of those would have been people who were close to the poverty level, who did not qualify for Medicaid. And Medicaid is not even across the country. Some states are more generous with Medicaid, and some states basically give very little Medicaid and basically don't do a good job covering the low-income part of the population. So the Affordable Care Act was really designed to expand Medicaid to a group that was just above the poverty level who pretty much could not afford health insurance. And basically for those who were a little bit better off to give subsidies. For the very rich, it didn't matter. They always can access good health care with or without insurance. So if the insurance situation gets worse, they just pay for the cost of the care. So it's really the middle class that really didn't benefit from the Affordable Care Act. The people, the poorest, definitely did, at least in certain states. However, as usual, there's a bait and switch. The bait was this. The Affordable Care Act said, all right, we want to encourage doctors to take Medicaid. So we will pay the doctors the same amount that we would pay them if the person had Medicare. The way it was before, Medicare paid a reasonable rate. Medicaid paid a much lower rate, which is why many physicians did not participate with Medicaid. And I'll tell you how bad this was. I remember taking Medicaid as insurance. I would see a patient in the office, and I would get $6 for that care, whether I spent an hour with the patient or I spent 20 minutes with the patient. And I wouldn't spend less than that because I can't see how one can deliver health care in much less time than that. But it would be $6. Well, eventually that rate got raised to $30. As you probably know, $30 is a cap fare generally, that may take about 10 minutes. So, and that barely covers the cost of that cab driver's cost to operate the car. So you can imagine operating a medical office and getting $6 a visit. That really didn't make sense. As a matter of fact, most physicians considered that an insult. So there clearly was an improvement over time, but once we got to the Affordable Care Act and we did increase the amount of people that had insurance, we didn't cover the entire population, we increased the amount of people who had insurance, we then did the switch. The switch was we took the Medicaid and we privatized it. In New York, most of Medicaid today is privatized. Many people who have Medicaid will understand what I'm talking about. They're going along with their Medicaid, and all of a sudden one day they got a letter in the mail that said, you are now a member of this insurance company. Just to give an example of the name, you are
Dr. Moore, let me just interrupt you since the clock is running away and I could listen and our listeners will listen to you more frequently because I know that you're going to be back for more home visits. But in the last minute that we have left for this segment, tell us about how we can get on board with the New York State legislature, a single-payer system in New York State, or Medicare for All. And well, the Assembly recently overwhelmingly passed such a bill. It hasn't gone through the Senate yet. How do we get on board with this? Because that's where we're going.
Definitely. New York Health Campaign, that's the site that you can go on to sign on to the single-payer bill in the Senate. New York Health Campaign. Or if you want to get more information, you can sign on to PNHP Metro. That's Physicians for a National Health Program, PNHP Metro. Metro meaning this area, New York. Either one of those sites, you can navigate your way to more information. You can sign a petition for Medicare for All. Well, in this case, it would be the New York Health Bill. So that in New York State, we can all have a decent health insurance that is affordable and that will cover the entire population in New York.
Promise to come back again?
Oh, I certainly would love to.
Well, we've been speaking to Dr. Donald Moore, MD, MPH, past president of the Medical Society of the County of Kings and board member, most significantly, of Physicians for a National Health Plan. And he made a home visit to get us on board for understanding and supporting and implementing, finally, a Medicare for All or a single-payer system. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Mimi. Have a great day.
America is a melting pot. Or is this a false accusation? Of the have-to-haves and the have-to-have-nots.
We're waiting in anticipation.
Singapore like Johnny on the spot.
In every other industrialized nation.
So when will we have what we have not got? Talking about a do-or-die situation.
No, we are not satisfied and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream.
Our next guest, who is speaking to us from El Salvador, Oscar Chacon, who's the executive director of Alianza Americas. When New York billionaire and GOP presidential candidate Donald Trump launched into his anti-immigrant tirade against Mexicans crossing the border, he was using a long-known political technique of plugging into the live wire of American resentment of the other. Most recently, Latinos, more precisely, those from southern borders, Mexicans, Salvadorians, Guatemalans, Hondurans, and the like. And no doubt, the recent tragedies in France will be exploited to promote a new wave of fear and antagonism towards immigrants and migrants of Arab descent. Oscar, thank you so much for joining us. Help put in perspective what perhaps hasn't been happening on the part of either the Republican or the Democratic candidates when it comes to meaningful immigration reform.
I think it is important for the listeners to understand that the calculation by at least a faction within the Republican Party leadership is that they can gain more voters than they lose by pandering to racism and xenophobia, specifically against Mexican and other Latin American immigrants in the U.S., and that this is not a conclusion that is universal among all Republicans, but clearly somebody like Donald Trump has come to believe that, again, I mean, that formula may well render a Republican in the White House. This is not a new formula. If we go back to 1994, there was a dying effort to reelect a Republican governor in California, and precisely by embracing the approach that is now being taken primarily by Donald Trump, that candidate, Pete Wilson, managed to actually get reelected and in the way actually pass one of the worst anti-immigrant laws by way of a referendum, Proposition 187. The history of these type of attacks didn't begin really with Donald Trump launching his presidential campaign last June, but it goes back at least 25 years. While the referendum I make mention of, Proposition 187, was largely neutralized by our federal court system because it was largely unconstitutional. The reality is that the most precious achievement of that particular wave of anti-immigrant sentiment didn't actually happen at a state level. It happened at the federal level with the passage of the most restrictive, the most exclusionary, and most punishable U.S. immigration law in history at the time, the so-called Illegal Immigration Reform and Immigrant Responsibility Act of 1996. All this assault against immigrants has taken place in the same stretch of time where we have seen the steady decay in the economic and social status of white segments of Americans, particularly of many white Americans who for long thought of themselves as middle class. And this has created a pernicious environment where economic insecurity and long-held racist and xenophobic beliefs have combined in a way that makes possible for extremist political offerings like the one being made by Donald Trump to actually gain traction. Now, where do Democrats have been standing in relationship to all of this? Frankly, most Democrats, at least since 1996 all the way to the present, have actually been able to get away, essentially being perceived as the good cops, I mean, in this story, when it comes to immigrants and immigration policy, by simply declaring that they like immigrants, but without actually doing tangible things to demonstrate how much those commitments really go. And we are only recently beginning to see a bit of change in this regard. In places, whether it is cities or states where Democrats fully control, you know, the political system, we haven't really seen a true embracing of the notion that immigrants are good for the country and therefore we ought to treat them, you know, with a great sense of equality. So in essence, you know, when I look at the presidential campaign already and I hear the Democratic Party candidates talking about immigrants, I am not yet hearing truly alternative ways in which a voter, especially a Latino voter for whom, you know, immigration is close to our heart, really hitting significantly different positions. And let me just give you five ideas what Democrats could do. They should begin to fully defy the notion that immigrants are bad for the country and speaking over and over again about all the positive contributions made by Mexican, Latin American, and other immigrants in the U.S. They should be consistently defying the rhetoric that paints immigrants as lawbreakers. Instead, they should be speaking about the fact that immigration policy, in a way, reflects the reality of an incapable political class that has failed to actually periodically and wisely modernize our immigration policies to reflect the kind of world we live in. Whenever Democrats are in political control positions, as I already said, they should be absolutely moving forward, passing laws that truly make immigrants equal members of our society. They should be flatly rejecting the 1996 immigration policy for its deeply xenophobic, racist, you know, nature, and instead they should be speaking about the importance of reversing that particular law and embracing a new immigration law that truly reflects all the good things that immigrants have actually contributed. And perhaps more importantly than all of the above, Democrats should be embracing fully the need to profoundly reform our social and economic system so that we can bring about a decisive break with the generation of policies enacted since essentially the late 1970s and forward that have brought us to the level of economic inequality that is so prevalent today. In the end, it is the duty of good citizens to find ways to get better politically organized so that we can push for these changes to come about and not just wait for a particular party or a particular politician to actually lead the way, because that's unlikely to happen.
After the catastrophic events in France, we have seen Donald Trump declaring that there should be inspection of mosques, possibly closing of mosques, a ferocious and frightening wave of antagonism and recalling of any sympathy for refugees from Syria. Can you build that into the mix in terms of the question of migration and the new antipathies to people of Arab descent?
No doubt about it. I mean, I think that we are likely to indeed see more of the kind of verbal attack against not just immigrants in general, but right now, probably once again, a focus on Muslims, a focus on Arabs, you know, immigrants in the country, as if they all are some sort of illness that we need to terminate. This is extremely dangerous because, as we well know, this is exactly the kind of wave that we saw post 9/11, and it did not do us any good because the reality is we need to look much more deeply into what is it that has led to the kind of events that we saw in Paris. It is important to keep in mind what we need to really do is to understand that the best way we can actually avoid going into a very dangerous path, I mean, attacking different kinds of immigrants just because we want to associate them with national security threats, is to actually embrace the notion that the best thing we could do is to open up a window of opportunity for these communities to actually be able to function fully as members of society, opening up, you know, immigration status for them. This would make very feasible for us to once and for all clear up that the vast majority of people who are in the U.S. as immigrants are there because they care about the country, because they're contributing, because they're not only helping the U.S., but also helping their own countries by virtue of remittances that they send on a monthly basis. And again, I mean, rather than tempting ourselves, I mean, with going again, I mean, into a path that is essentially a path where we only saw more suspicion about one another, we should be embracing a path that is more about building harmony in society.
You seem to be moving in the direction of saying neither the Democratic and certainly not the Republican Party are going to come up with the kind of agenda and the kind of initiatives that is going to lead to meaningful immigration reform. So where do we place our eggs? In which basket? Is it a more robust and muscular response from our communities led particularly by people who are immigrants? Is that what we need to do?
Absolutely. If one thing history teaches us is that it has hardly ever been the case that the people in D.C., the people in Congress, are actually ahead of the rest of us on what needs to happen. I mean, they can respond, but it is imperative that we understand that we must put most of our faith in actually getting common people to be able to organize and to organize, you know, politically in a way that we can actually influence what kind of debate and what kind of decision making happens. I don't believe that we are departing from zero. I mean, there is a lot already going on, but there is indeed much more harmony, much more synergy that needs to be built among multiple actors that, as I said, I mean, are already engaged. But I think it is important to not get lost on the idea that if we elect, you know, candidate A versus candidate B, that in itself is going to produce miracles. I think that we need to understand that re-engineering ourselves, I mean, from a, you know, social, political, organizing capability is what in the end will make a difference and will allow us to sustain whatever change we can bring about in the short term.
What is fundamental that must be accomplished?
Well, I mean, I think that they all have been promising that if they get elected, that they will do more executive actions. I welcome those announcements, but on the other hand, I ask myself, what could a new president do that President Obama didn't already try to do? I think that we need to be more careful about what is it that we can do. And I really believe that if nothing else, presidential candidates on the Democratic side should be unified in criticizing universally the 1996 immigration law and really calling for its abolishment, for its replacement from ground up, so that we can have an immigration law that is much more reflective of how important immigrant communities are for the U.S. And of course, I mean, fight back against this rhetoric that essentially suggests that immigrants are some sort of threat to the country when the opposite is actually reality.
Oscar Chacon, Executive Director of Alianza, you're terrific. And thank you for setting us on the correct path at this most precarious time for our sisters and brothers who are immigrants.
This has been Building Bridges, your community and labor report with Mimi Rosenberg.
And Ken Nash. And log on to our website at www.buildingbridgesradio.org.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next,
This Way Out.
When we talk about the gay window, talk about this gay consciousness, speak to young gay people and talk to them directly, they look right at you and say, oh, this is perfectly true, and I never thought about it before until this moment. So that in effect, what we have been doing is talking to gay people and telling them to recognize what they know.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Lucia Chappell. Irish eyes smile at the country's first same-gender weddings, adoption reform expands Portugal's queer families, and a liberated librarian questions the original radical fairy. Those stories and more this week because you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Wendell Jones.
And I'm John Dyer V.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBT communities around the world for the week ending November 21st, 2015. Lesbian and gay couples started marching down the aisle in the Republic of Ireland on November 16th, the first day that the country's marriage equality law came into effect. Voters approved opening civil marriage to same-gender couples in a landslide referendum earlier this year. Clonmel Senior Registrar Mary Claire Heffernan told reporters that Richard Dowling and Cormac Gallooly were the first same-gender couple to wed in the country. They tied the knot in a low-key mourning ceremony outside the registrar's office at Clonmel Community Care Centre. Dowling told Irish broadcaster RTE that he and Gallooly contracted a civil partnership in mid-September. All our family and friends were there, he said. That was really our wedding day. But he stressed that this is formalizing the legalities of our marriage. While discussing other goals yet to be achieved, Kieran Rose of Ireland's Gay and Lesbian Equality Network celebrated what he called this joyful and historic moment, noting that it is the end of a long legal journey that began with the decriminalization in 1993, equality legislation in the 1990s, civil partnership in 2010, and culminated in the passing of the marriage equality referendum in May. But he added, today is an especially magical moment for the lesbian and gay couples who start their new journeys together as married couples.
Married gay and lesbian couples in Portugal will now be able to adopt children under a bill that passed in Parliament on November 20th. It builds on a law passed in 2013 that permitted same-gender couples to adopt their partner's children. The new legislation also allows lesbian couples to access medically assisted fertility services. Activists celebrated the right's advance, especially since the bill to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples may have passed in 2010 only because it specifically banned those couples from adoption. Left-of-center parties in the current parliamentary majority, including the Socialist, Communist, and Left Bloc parties, each made adoptions equality an issue in last month's general elections campaign. The outgoing equality-resistant center-right coalition subsequently lost its parliamentary majority. The exact tally of the November 20th adoptions equality vote hadn't been announced by the time we recorded this newscast, but the Speaker of Portugal's Parliament confirmed to reporters that the legislation had passed. The country is currently in political limbo, with the left-wing opposition waiting to take power. Agence France-Presse reports that President Aníbal Cavaco Silva needs to decide whether or not to charge Socialist Party leader António Costa with forming a new Portuguese government. Some have publicly wondered whether or not Costa's fragile leftist alliance can be sustained.
Elsewhere, lawmakers in Kenya have rejected a bill to impose a death by stoning punishment for anyone convicted of engaging in private, consensual, adult, same-gender sex. The Justice and Legal Affairs Committee in the East African Nation's Parliament refused for the second time in 2 years to allow the proposal to advance to the full chamber for debate. A committee spokesman told the media that its members think that the existing penalty of up to 14 years in prison is enough. Leading Kenyan LGBT rights activist Dennis Nzioka called the death of the bill a very good step, but told Gay Star News that increased public discussion of the issue has fueled the homophobia that already festers in the country. "We have seen a lot of anti-gay sentiment being brought out by people, politicians, religious leaders. People want to go the Ugandan way, Nigerian way. I thought Kenya was a safe country, the best in the continent apart from South Africa for gay rights," he said. "But things have got out of our hands. It just shows how in an instant things can change dramatically."
LGBT activists and their allies around the world marked the 16th annual Transgender Day of Remembrance on November 20th by honoring, in local memorials and celebrations of life and in online media, the 271 trans people who were reported murdered in the past year. According to Transgender Europe's Trans Murder Monitoring, this year's 271 murders is a significant increase from the 226 people reported killed last year because of their actual or perceived gender identity. The group says 85% of anti-trans murders are committed in the Americas, and many more homicides against trans people, mostly trans women and frequently trans women of color, go unreported. Activists fear that next year's numbers will be even worse, especially in the U.S., where transphobic No Men in Women's Bathroom campaigns are the new wave of far-right fundamentalist attacks on sexual minorities. The Transgender Day of Remembrance began in 1998 in Massachusetts at a demonstration to mourn the brutal murder of Rita Hester, a transgender African-American woman.
In other news, and from the Lengths People Will Go To file, the board of directors of a charter school in Rutherford County, North Carolina, voted this week to suspend all of its extracurricular clubs rather than allow a support group for LGBT students and their friends. Lake Lure Classical Academy serves children from kindergarten through high school. The Daily Courier, a newspaper based in nearby Forest City, reported that a raucous school board meeting this week saw heated debate for and against the newly formed lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender club, where an overwhelming majority of local parents, pastors, and even some teachers expressed outrage at the idea. Visual arts teacher Lane Long had allowed the club to meet in her classroom. "This is not a religious club. This is a human rights club," she said. "My father's a Christian, and I've been brought up to understand that God is love. Jesus wants to help people." School director Jessica Boland told the Daily Courier that, "From the school side, the issues aren't as prevalent as the outside community is making it. I find it disappointing that we have to suspend all clubs." Perhaps ironically, one of those suspended clubs is a faith-based group named for the school's mascot, Raptors for Christ. Other clubs on the hit list include the drama and chess clubs. Lake Lure is a tourist community promoted as a place where the 1980s blockbuster Dirty Dancing was filmed.
The Utah judge who sparked a firestorm by issuing an order to remove a 9-month-old baby girl from her foster moms just because they're lesbians is now off the case. April Hoagland and Becky Pierce were legally married in 2014 and want to eventually adopt the baby girl with the blessing of her birth mother and approval by a number of state agencies and officials. But juvenile court judge Scott Johansson ruled that research showed that children do better in homes with a mother and a father. No credible scientific studies have come to that conclusion, however. Some research, in fact, suggests that children raised by same-gender couples are often more open to diversity and have more empathy for other people than kids brought up in so-called nuclear families. Even putting his removal order on hold and scheduling a best interests of the child hearing for early December didn't seem to satisfy Johansson's critics. Citing the continuing public outrage, some people were calling for his removal from the bench, Johansson removed himself from the foster mom's case this week. The Salt Lake Tribune reports that it's now unclear if that early December hearing will be held, or what happens next in the legal arena following Johansson's withdrawal. But Hoagland and Pierce issued a media statement expressing thanks for the outpouring of love and support from people all across the nation.
And finally, perennial far-right U.S. Republican presidential wannabe Mike Huckabee has learned that hell hath no fury like a survivor scorned. Guitarist Frankie Sullivan co-wrote the song Eye of the Tiger, the well-known theme from the Rocky movie franchise performed by his group, Survivor. He filed a lawsuit against the former Arkansas governor in an Illinois federal court this week, accusing Huckabee of violating the copyright of the song by allowing it to play when Huckabee escorted the now infamous Rowan County, Kentucky clerk, Kim Davis, onto the stage at a rally following her release from jail. A judge had put her there for refusing to do her government job, to issue valid marriage licenses to qualified heterosexual and same-gender couples. Eye of the Tiger blared from loudspeakers outside Carter County Detention Center as Huckabee and self-proclaimed born-again Christian Davis appeared on stage arm-in-arm after she was sprung from a 5-day stint in lockup. The judge let her out after she satisfied him that she wouldn't interfere with her subordinates issuing marriage licenses to all qualified couples, regardless of sexual orientation. Sullivan previously sued former House Speaker and failed GOP presidential hopeful Newt Gingrich in 2012 for using the same song at several of his campaign rallies. Sullivan's new lawsuit is no real surprise. He expressed support for LGBT rights on the band's Facebook page soon after the rally and discussed that the song had been used without permission. "No, we did not grant Kim Davis any rights to use my tune, The Eye of the Tiger. I would not grant her the rights," he wrote. Referencing a popular brand of toilet paper, he added that he would not grant her the rights to use Charmin.
That's News Wrap for the week ending November 21st, 2015. Produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org. Where you can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm John Dyer V.
I'm Tanya King Perry for This Way Out. We need your help to keep this one-of-a-kind international radio show on the air. Please log on to thiswayout.org to let us know you're out there. That's thiswayout.org.
And if you're out there on Tuesday, December 1st, how about a Giving Tuesday tip of the hat to Overnight Productions, Inc. in support of This Way Out? Make it hashtag GivingTWO Day on hashtag Giving Tuesday. Cool surprises and special offers on tap.
I had been an active gay person, I suppose, since about the time I was 17 or 18. As a matter of fact, I sort of came out in the fall of 1931 on the Stanford campus, declaring myself to be homosexual, that I would not pretend, I would not pull a mask over myself, I would say who I was, and declared myself openly.
Long before queer theory was an academic discipline, there was Harry Hay. And long before there were well-funded libraries and archival collections of LGBT history, there was Jim Kepner. Hay's life is explored in Stuart Timmons' biography, The Trouble with Harry Hay, and Eric Slade's ITVS documentary, Hope Along the Wind. To really understand Hay's role in the development of queer consciousness, we turn to a 1975 interview when he expressed the original ideas that led to the founding of Radical Fairies in 1979. The occasion was the first day-long marathon of LGBT programming on KPFK Los Angeles, and the interviewer was another late great movement pioneer, Jim Kepner, founder of the International Gay and Lesbian Archives, a collection that is now part of the One Archives at the USC Libraries. Their discussion begins with some early history.
After 1953, the Mattachine Societies, which by that time had spread to several major cities, placed the emphasis on the physical elements, on the performance of sex acts, on the question of whether there was a genetic or hormonal imbalance or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
Do you consider this a part of the breakaway from the original Mattachine ideals?
Yes, I certainly
and in
do.
What way do you
the original,
that?
The original society, or what we, you know, the people who were involved in the original society were concerned with two major questions with a possible third. First was who we were, who were we, and second of all, what were we for? And then when we knew all this and had put all this together, this is what our idea was, to find out all we could possibly find out about ourselves. And when we knew, then to negotiate a relationship between ourselves and the parent society as a group, as an entire group. Also, we introduced at this time the name homophile. And the idea of using the name homophile at that time was to call attention to ourselves as persons, to ask the society to hold us to account as persons, and not in terms of clinical acts, which is what we were at that time. We were a criminal act at this point. We wanted to be seen as spiritual, intellectual, political persons and be called to account as social persons.
In your own background, did your consciousness of being different precede your involvement in sexual activity?
Oh, considerably, considerably. I had a vision, Jimmy, which I can remember having, oh, maybe by the time I was 9 or 10 years old, of a vision that someday I would see and I would meet this other person who would be my lifelong companion. This is not a way to put it. 9 or 10 years old. 9 or 10 years old, I was looking for that other boy I wanted to be able to be, I didn't know, but all kinds of things with. And I could see him standing on a hillside, and he was holding his hands out to me, and we would run, and we would go to see the sunrise, and we would never be separated.
I guess I wasn't the only one looking for that sunrise, sunset.
As a matter of fact, I've even talked to young straights about this, and I find the same thing, particularly ones who have a doubtful vision, and I always say to them, look, that's your real dream. Whatever the sex of that person who is calling you to run to the top of the hill to see the sunrise or the sunset, this is the one you're looking for.
Mm-hmm. What do you see as our priorities now?
Well, frankly, I would say that what has happened is that ground has been cleared, space has been given for us to get down to the real business of doing what we're supposed to be doing. And I would say that our real work now is to begin to establish the gay vision and begin to show that the gay vision is something that has within itself an enormous contribution to make to the parent society. We are people who have been thrown up generation after generation throughout the millennia by the forces of natural selection. And through that, we are able to do certain things. We are able to act as a mirror to see certain things that the straights can't possibly see.
Such as?
Well, among other things, we have ourselves played this role, most of us. I mean, any of us who are, say, past 40 have probably had the experience of being what is known as the office queen. And the office queen is usually a person to whom everybody seems to have some reason for wanting to tell secrets to. So, in effect, we become people who explain the men to the women and the women to the men. Now, realizing that we ourselves, by the time we were 15, had to learn to see the way the straights see in the world, or we would probably have been beat to death. You know, we wouldn't have been able to get through junior high school. But we have our own gay window. And
to the extent that we begin to appreciate and become conscious of the fact that we have our own window on the world, our own value judgments, we are generally non-competitive, non-aggressive people. We very early find that we want to cooperate with people at a point when that hasn't been explained to you yet, and where that's not where the kids are at all. The straights take their aggressive competition as a matter of course. If we're going to play in that peer game, we have to learn it, and we have to learn it very hard because it's very difficult for us to do, which means, among other things, that we have to learn to copy the straights. We not only copy the boys, but we copy how the boys do it, so we know that when the girls react to us, they react to us in a way so that they're not going to get wise to the fact that we're different, and the rest of the boys aren't going to notice that we're any different, too. So we learn how to do these things. And therefore, once we realize that we can see through their window and our own gay window, we can actually have a triangular vision.
We would not keep reappearing under the laws of natural selection over the millennia if we didn't in some way favor survival. And now I'm suggesting that if that is the case, that we begin to use it consciously and begin to act in a responsible way to the spiritual survival of our family, namely Homo sapiens. In other words, to begin to talk subjectively rather than simply objectively. When we talk about the gay window, mention the gay window, talk about this gay consciousness, speak to young gay people and talk to them directly, they look right at you and say, yeah, this is perfectly true, and I never thought about it before until this moment. So that in effect, what we have been doing is talking to gay people and saying, telling them to recognize what they know. They will say that we're helping them to know what they know, or calling them to understand what they know, because they may never have understood it before, but the moment that we mention it to them, they sort of reach out as though they were kind of pulling words out of your mouth, and we just go right on from there. We know exactly what we're talking about.
You mentioned the other day the interpretation of a major Shakespeare sonnet, which has the gay implication.
When first your eye, I eyed. Mm-hmm. Now, we have to recognize that the moment that any gay person reads that line, we know exactly what he's talking about, because we've been going around eyeballing people. This is our way of recognizing each other, whether we're in Japan or New Zealand or what's the other place there that I used to love so much, Herzegovina, or
Bosnia,
the United States.
Yeah,
well, I don't know about Bosnia, but Herzegovina, you know, if I eyeball another eyeball, I know what he's talking about, he knows what I'm talking about, and we get behind the nearest bush.
Well, it's significant that a fairy wrote the story of the ugly duckling.
Yes. Very important, I think. I mean, after all, he certainly was an ugly duckling himself. Yes.
Much of what you're saying goes around the frequent and troublesome question of whether we're aiming at separatism or at integration.
We have to be separatists to a certain extent. To the extent that we're going to discover who we are, begin to appreciate who we are, begin to learn to exercise these differences in ourselves, we are going to be separatists, yes. In the same way that the black people have done the same, the Chicano people have done the same. We draw together. And let's also face the fact that we know, as Hirschfeld put it many, many years ago, that first of all, gays are good for each other. We used to think of ourselves as a brotherhood. I now prefer a family, because in a family, there is a sense of giving space to the other members, taking responsibility that they have this spiritual space that we can all grow together in the way that we would like to grow. We know as gays that straights invade us. They invade us constantly. We need to refresh and renew ourselves, and we do that best with ourselves, with each other, in the family. I think all the minorities want, we want unity and diversity. In other words, we want to be a part of a total community. We want to give and contribute to the total community, but we'd like to give it from ourselves, and we would like to some extent to give it on our terms, too.
You mentioned unity and diversity. When you say that gays look out through a certain type of window, are you saying that all gays are alike? This is a thing that bugs some people.
No. I don't think so. The window is a wide spectrum. We have to recognize that our the gay window overlaps the straight window. The straight window goes, let's say, 10 degrees to the left, and the gay window goes 10 degrees to the right. And then there's an overlap in the middle where we both see through. And into that gay window, there are probably there are as many slots as there are gay people, really, Jimmy.
Do you see the gay movement as having any relation? Do we have any interest in other group, ethnic minorities, in women's rights, in peace, ecology?
Of course we do. I mean, when you come right down to it, the fact that we're tossed out of the nest early, the fact that we smell wrong to our fathers by the time we're 3 and 4 in a great many cases, you know, this old business about it's because Papa treated you wrong at 4, I don't think it ever occurs to our psychologists that maybe we smelled wrong at 4 and Pa was reacting to that, to the ugly duckling and not to the nice little white ones that ought to be doing this and that. Well, anyway, the fact that we have been out of it and very early means that a great many of us have been examining what we call the unexamined assumptions of the total society an awfully long time and finding them wanting. And then beginning to say, no, you know, I wish I could tell them that all they have to do is stretch a little bit to the right or a little bit to the left, and they would have a much more whole thing than they have, and that would include me. And I want to be included. I don't want to be separate. I think that, in a way, much of the oppression of all of the third world people, all of the minorities, is equally true for us, and because it's true for us, we should be joined with all of them.
And you would see then that the chief goal of the gay movement is along social, spiritual lines rather than just law reform and claiming our seat on the bus.
Exactly. We don't belong in the nest. We don't belong inside the ghetto. And certainly the gay ghetto is as deadening and as sucking in on people as any other ghetto is. I think that we belong in the avant-garde. We belong out at the forefront of living. We are people because of the light baggage that we carry, socially speaking, that we are in a position to try out all kinds of experiments for the whole society to take a look at and to reject or accept in pieces they choose. And I think that we're in a position to do just that. After all, we're fairies, for heaven's sake.
Harry Hay joined the Fairies in the Sky in 2002. He was interviewed by Jim Kepner, who was shelved in the Heavenly Archives in 1997. Next time on This Way Out.
Since its initial detection in 1981, HIV has gone on to infect more than 75 million people worldwide. Dr. Michael Gottlieb first documented AIDS as a disease back then.
At any time, there'd be 20 or 30 patients on a ward, all with AIDS, and it was like a MASH unit. He would patch them up and send them out, and they'd be back weeks or months later with some other horrible infection. But the fact that there are 35 million people in the world today living with HIV, and that that information never makes it into the mainstream media, that troubles me.
Both the troubling realities and the hopeful news will capture global attention on the 27th World AIDS Day on December 1st. Next time on This Way Out, Rick Watts examines the past, present, and future of HIV/AIDS with Dr. Michael Gottlieb, one of the first doctors in the U.S. to identify and treat the immune system-suppressing disease. An enlightening and ultimately uplifting conversation awaits next time on This Way Out. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. This week, Wenzel Jones, John Dyer V, Tanya Kane Perry, and Rick Watts contributed program material, with thanks, as always, to Steve Pride.
Tim Kaine and Boys Entrance and Margie Adam performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Yavanna Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener supporters, for making this program possible. You'll find more information about the show, the crew, our social media links, and hashtag GivingTWODay at thiswayout.org. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California, 90078, USA. For coordinating producer Greg Gordon and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Lucia Chappell. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org, on iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher, and on WPKM Bridgeport, Connecticut, 3BBB Ballarat, Victoria, KYRS Medical Lake, Spokane, Washington, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Now y'all stay tuned.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
Today on Against the Grain, missionaries tried to convert Native Americans, federal officials sought to seize Indian lands, and the Indians, well, they owned slaves, black slaves, in the southern United States. I'm CS. Historian Barbara Krauthammer describes what happened when missionaries, slaves, and Native Americans encountered each other in the context of the U.S. colonial project, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. So many stories and agendas and racial and power dynamics converge in today's story, or rather, the story told by an historian named Barbara Krauthammer. There's the story of the U.S. government's brutal treatment of Native Americans. There's the story of Christian missionaries sent to convert and, quote, civilize Native peoples. There's the fact that Native Americans in the southern U.S. owned slaves of African descent. There's also the story of racial ideologies, how whites viewed Indians and African Americans, how Indians viewed their black slaves, and how slaves viewed their Native American masters. Barbara Krauthammer's work reveals the complex dimensions, dynamics, and contradictions that, among other things, trouble the bright line distinctions we tend to make between colonizer and colonized. Krauthammer is an associate professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst and the author of Black Slaves, Indian Masters: Slavery, Emancipation, and Citizenship in the Native American South. She also contributed a chapter about missionaries, slaves, and Native Americans to the volume Formations of United States Colonialism, edited by Alyosha Goldstein and published by Duke University Press. When Barbara joined me from the studios of WMUA in Amherst, Massachusetts, I asked her to describe the U.S. government's strategy in relation to Indians living in the Deep South in the early 19th century.
I think the U.S. government's relation to Native Americans in the Deep South in the early 19th century was complicated. On the one hand, there were certainly many people in the government and many civilians who wanted, with perhaps the best of intentions, perhaps not, wanted to recognize Native people's sovereignty and right to their territory, rights to self-government. But I think the story that perhaps people are more familiar with is the story of the rapid expansion of plantation slavery and plantation agriculture. And so I think the economic and social and political demands generated by Southern landowners, Southern land speculators, Southern politicians to open up more land to plantation agriculture, to that plantation regime, really drove the pressure to start the removal process, right? That forcible removal of Southern nations to the West. And that was a process that had roots that dated back to the American Revolution, right? As early as the American Revolution, early U.S. politicians were already thinking about how to consolidate U.S. control over that Southern territory. But the process really gained momentum and strength and violence by the 1820s, 1830s.
So the U.S. government wanted to relocate Indians westward in order to open up lands for plantations.
Right, for white landowners, for white men to own land and to make that land what seemed in the eyes of white Americans to be profitable, right, to generate capital and wealth.
And what other agendas or designs did the U.S. government have in relation to the Indians in terms of either assimilating them or just generally what they wanted to turn the Native Americans into what kind of people?
Right. Well, this was always the complicated and contradictory aspect of federal policy and benevolent societies, religious organizations' stance towards Native peoples in the Deep South, right? That simultaneously there was a sense that Native peoples could and should be assimilated into the American mainstream, right, the dominant white society, and that that assimilation could take place through conversion to Christianity, through English language education, through things like changing cultural patterns, changing dress and domestic lifestyles, changing gender roles. So really a full-scale cultural assault, if you will. And on the one hand, there was a sense that Indians could be integrated and assimilated into the mainstream society. And yet at the same time, I think there was always a sense of white supremacy that Native peoples could never fully become like white people, right? That they could adopt the cultural and economic and social patterns of the dominant society and be recognized as, let's say, aspirational, but that white Americans were probably not inclined to recognize Native peoples as truly equal.
You write that the federal authorities hoped to push Indians to adopt the practices of American yeoman farmers.
Right, that I think there was a sense that if Native peoples could be convinced or forced to own the land as private property as opposed to owning the land as a commons, which those southern nations owned their land in common, right? Anyone who could farm and work the land could claim a piece of that land to work. And in the American system, people own land as private property and use that land to generate private wealth. And so I think there were for many people a vision of Native peoples becoming small landowners, small farmers, individual entrepreneurs, with the notion being that that would make them more like white Americans rather than less.
What did the organizations that sent missionaries to Indian lands in the Deep South, like lands in Mississippi where the Choctaw lived, what did these organizations, these mission organizations, think of the way the feds treated Indians?
I think missionaries and the churches that sponsored them had multiple visions of how the federal government treated Native peoples. I think on the one hand, missionaries saw themselves as benevolent. I'm not sure the Native peoples they lived among necessarily agreed with that perspective, but I think the missionaries believed that they were benevolent even when their treatment was harsh, right? Even when they imposed harsh discipline, corporal punishment, berated Native students in their schools, for example. I think they, the missionaries, believed that they were really being benevolent in that they were safeguarding Native communities from being overrun by white settlers, for example. At the same time, I think missionaries took a very critical and harsh view towards the Native peoples that they were ostensibly being benevolent towards, right? That they were very critical of the lack of Christianity, of the unwillingness, right, and of Native resistance to Christianity, of Native resistance to dominant Anglo-American gender roles, for example. And so I think missionaries were in a bit of a bind and put themselves in that bind.
You mentioned that part of the agenda of the missionaries, or at least some of them, was to safeguard the Native peoples from being overrun by white settlers. So does that mean that they disapproved of the way the federal government was encouraging this white settlement and this dislocation and displacement of Native peoples?
Yes, well, I think their disapproval was directed perhaps more towards individual white squatters and intruders. And I think there was a sense as well that the federal policies towards Native peoples were too aggressive and were not humane. And so while missionaries were very much steeped in and embraced ideals of white supremacy, I think they also fancied themselves as better humanitarians than the federal government, and so that they really saw themselves as protecting Native communities from being physically assaulted by white vigilantes, white squatters, white land speculators, who they saw as having no regard for Native people's lives.
Well, this is an interesting question. The extent to which the missionary project fit within a kind of broader project to colonize and subjugate indigenous people and their land. So to what extent did missionaries see themselves as proxies for the U.S. colonial project?
I think they saw themselves as proxies certainly for the social and cultural aspects of the colonial project, right? That they really believed in their Christianizing mission. They really believed in inherent and abstract values of English language education, of adopting American styles of dress, American gender roles and labor patterns. And so I think they were wholly committed to that and did not have an especially critical stance towards that. And I think in many respects, they were committed to the attendant changes in economic patterns, right? That they envisioned Native peoples remaining perhaps self-governing or quasi-self-governing, but really as an appendage to the American economy and the American social and cultural mainstream.
We could see the effort to convert Native Americans to Christianity as separate and apart from the project of appropriating and acquiring and taking Indian lands. Do you see those two projects as distinct?
I don't. I actually think that they're interwoven, because the sense among federal officials, among so-called reformers, and among missionaries was that that idea of being an independent landowner, generating wealth for one's own benefit, for one's family, was very much tied to what were seen as Christian ideals, right, of being virtuous and thrifty and diligent and hardworking. And so all of these ideals were really understood as Christian ideals. And so that conversion really went hand in hand with those sort of coercive changes in labor, in land ownership, in tribal sovereignty.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Barbara Krauthammer joins us. She's an associate professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, and she's author of Black Slaves, Indian Masters, Slavery, Emancipation, and Citizenship in the Native American South. So you've investigated specifically, well, you've investigated many things, but I want to talk to you about your investigation into the lands that the Choctaw Indians occupied, resided on in Mississippi in the early 19th century, and the missionaries who came to set up shop there. And maybe we could begin with some basic facts about the Choctaw Indians and where they lived in this area and how long they had been there.
Sure. The Choctaws claimed, by the early 19th century, the Choctaws claimed almost all of what we know as the state of Mississippi as their territory. And their right to that territory had been recognized by European empires, the Spanish, the French, the British. Their claims to that territory came under assault in the years after the American Revolution. And then after the U.S. gained control of that Louisiana territory after Jefferson's Louisiana Purchase. And their claims to the territory come under assault because of the rivers that run through that territory, because of access to New Orleans and trade routes that Americans were now interested in controlling and capitalizing on. Choctaw roots in the Mississippi Territory went back hundreds, thousands of years, right? And there are many wonderful studies about the ancient Mississippi kingdoms and chiefdoms in the region. But certainly, right, we can think back to the 16th century and early records by Europeans arriving in that region and interacting with the early Choctaw peoples, right, the peoples who would coalesce into the Choctaw Nation of the 19th century.
And by the time the missionaries arrived in Choctaw territory in the early 1800s, to what extent had the tribe or parts of it been displaced already, made to give up their lands prior to 1818, 1820?
So prior to the 1820s, small factions had been displaced, partially in consequence, as a consequence of intertribal rivalries, but really the large-scale displacement doesn't happen until the late 1820s and the early 1830s. And so there's this moment in time when missionaries arrive in the Choctaw Territory in Mississippi and build schools and churches and mission stations. And the Choctaws have a complicated, intense relationship with those missionaries, because I think on the one hand, there's a sense, at least among some Choctaw leaders, that hosting the missionaries and accepting the missionary presence might be a good strategy for ultimately safeguarding Choctaw territory and Choctaw political autonomy, right? That is, by accepting these envoys from the United States, these sort of quasi-independent, quasi-governmental representatives, that Choctaw leaders might be able to position themselves and their nation as willing allies with American economic agendas, American social values, American cultural and religious practices. But that's a very short-lived moment.
And I want to get back to that, this interesting question of what the Indians believe they could acquire from, appropriate from the missionaries and the education provided by the missions to their advantage, to the Native Americans' advantage. But before we get there, there's an interesting fact that I don't think is widely known, and that is, as you claim, Choctaw Indians, some of them, owned slaves.
Many Southern Native peoples owned African Americans as slaves, as property, as chattel. And the interesting history that is not very widely known, though I think is gaining some ground, is this interesting moment in the 1700s under French colonialism, Spanish colonialism, British colonialism in this southeastern territory, a shift in Native patterns of captivity and subordination. And so peoples like the Choctaw, for example, had previously held other Native peoples as subordinates and servants. And after many generations of contact with colonial officials, Spanish, French, and British, and after many years of encountering the rise of African enslavement in North America, there's a slow but definitive shift among the Choctaws and many other Native communities, a shift away from holding other Native peoples as subordinates and servants towards taking Africans and African Americans as subordinates and keeping them in a subordinate position, right? That is not opening ways for people to gain freedom or greater autonomy, not opening ways for people to be fully incorporated into a host society, but drawing stark divisions based on ideas of race or innate biological and ancestral difference, and creating these different categories that some people were servants for life, and that that category was a lifelong condition and was also one that was inherited, right, that was passed from mother to child. And what we see among the Choctaws is by the late 1700s that that idea of slavery being lifelong and inherited and also associated with African ancestry really takes root among the Choctaws, as it does among other southern Indian peoples.
How prevalent was this slaveholding by Indians of people of African descent? And what did the missionaries think of the Indians' ownership of slaves?
Slaveholding among the Choctaws and Chickasaws and other southern nations, in terms of percentages, looks fairly like slaveholding among white Southerners, right? That the majority of enslaved people are owned by a small minority of Native slaveholders, and that the majority of that wealth is also concentrated in the hands of a small elite class of plantation owners, but that certainly there were many more Native peoples who owned only a few enslaved people, one or two who worked on small farms with them. The missionaries, again, had a complicated relationship with Native slaveholders. On the one hand, missionaries were very committed to their project of assimilating Native peoples. And to that extent, while missionaries professed their anti-slavery sentiment, they were nonetheless willing to tolerate Native peoples' ownership of African Americans, right? And believed that that was the price they might have to pay for converting Native peoples, for enticing Native peoples to participate in this acculturation project of theirs. At the same time, missionaries could often be very critical of Native slaveholders. But what's interesting, I found, is that their criticism is voiced in terms that echoed prevailing racist sentiment towards Indians. That is, that missionaries would criticize Indian slaveholders for being especially bloodthirsty, especially cruel, lacking Christian benevolence like white slaveholders have. And so there was this sort of rhetoric that Native slaveholders were bloodthirsty and savage. And at the same time, there was another seemingly contradictory rhetoric that said Native slaveholders were absolutely lax and lenient and were nothing like white slaveholders because, of course, they lacked that Euro-American drive for wealth and property accumulation, and so that they were actually bad slaveholders, missionaries said, because they didn't know how to fully exploit black labor.
Well, there is a notion out there, and it's held by many, that Indians, by virtue of their Indianness, were somehow more lenient and more benevolent masters. What should be said about that?
Well, I think there are a lot of things we can say about that. In part, what interested me about this project that I did was thinking about how those ideas of Indians as benevolent masters in many ways reflect that history of colonialism, right? Of missionaries and other white Americans looking at Indians and saying, oh, they're so different from us. They don't understand capitalism. They don't want private wealth. And so they're flawed at keeping black people properly subjugated and properly exploited. And so I think there's an interesting history of racism underlying that narrative of Indian leniency. And at the same time, I think that there is a history of African-American, Native American alliance and joint efforts to resist U.S. imperialism and domination and to resist white supremacy. And so I think some parts of that narrative of Native willingness to recognize black people's humanity comes from that very real history of joint opposition to that colonial project.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Barbara Krauthammer is my guest. She teaches history at UMass Amherst, and she contributed a chapter about missionaries, slaves, and Native Americans to the volume Formations of United States Colonialism, edited by Alyosha Goldstein and published by Duke University Press. And that chapter encapsulates some of what Barbara wrote in her book, Black Slaves, Indian Masters. We are talking specifically about the dynamics of power and control that arose as Indians, slaves, and missionaries encountered each other in the Deep South in the early 19th century. So let's delve deeper into this, the perceptions held by Choctaws toward the missionaries who moved into their communities. So on the one hand, you have these missionaries condemn the slaveholding of blacks, of people of African descent, by Indians. And on the other hand, as you said earlier, that some, at least some Choctaws, welcomed the missions to the degree that they saw the missions as a way of maybe helping their cause, helping their communities. What was the basis for this sense that, you know, maybe the missionaries and their political views might help me, or maybe something I learn at the missionary schools or churches could help me and help my community combat some of the pernicious agendas directed at Indians?
Choctaw leaders were terrifically savvy politicians, political strategists, and diplomats, right? Were terrifically savvy at negotiating and navigating that shifting terrain of diplomatic relations with the U.S. government. And I think that Choctaw leaders were acutely aware that they were in a precarious position in terms of their right to their territory and their right to self-government. And one of the strategies that many, certainly not all, but that many leaders embraced or flirted with sometimes was the strategy of welcoming missionaries with the goal not so much of Christian conversion. I don't think that was driving their interest in welcoming the missionaries. But I think many leaders understood that if their children gained English language education, gained greater familiarity with the American market economy, with American economic practices, gained contacts, right, personal contacts with American political figures, leading merchants and bankers, for example, that they would be in a better position to do two things. First, to say to U.S. leaders, look, we're doing exactly what you wanted us to do, right? We've taken up private property. We've taken up commercial agriculture, right? We are as civilized as you asked us to be, on the one hand. And then on the other hand, they were also hopefully positioning themselves to better defend themselves, right? To say, right, we will speak in English and argue for our right to national sovereignty, right? Argue for our rights to safeguard our borders and our territories. And so I think that interest in courting the missionaries was really about gaining access to the tools that the federal government was trying to use against Native peoples, and that it was this very savvy decision to say, well, we will take those tools and use them for our defense.
And to what degree was this balanced by the sense that we need to be suspicious of these missionaries? They may try and abolish slavery in our midst, that kind of thing.
Right. Well, there was always a sense among those Native leaders who opposed any interaction with the missionaries to those who fully embraced interacting with the missionaries. There was always a skepticism of the missionaries' stated agenda and unstated agenda. And so there was always this sense that these anti-slavery missionaries were going to come and disrupt the existing economic patterns and wealth that was being generated through the ownership of enslaved workers. And so there is, on the one hand, this real concern that missionaries are going to disrupt the patterns of social and economic life in Choctaw territory. And there's also an understanding that this disruption itself is part of a colonial project, right? Is part of this insistence on the part of missionaries and federal agents to say, we know better than you about how your society should operate.
Your article in Formations of United States Colonialism begins with the dispatching of missionaries by the Boston-based American Board of Commissioners for Foreign Missions in the summer of 1818 to the Choctaw Indians' territory in Mississippi. And so they go to this area, they set up shop, and you note, in fact, well, they noted that a number of black slaves, so black slaves owned by Choctaw Indian slaveholders, attended the public worship services held at the mission. What was behind this, and what motivated blacks to go to these worship services?
So enslaved black people went to mission churches because many of them were practicing Christians, had Christian roots and ties to black churches and black communities in other parts of the Deep South, those places from which they had been sold to Choctaw territory. So I think for some people it was a way of continuing not just their religious faith, but a sense of connection to the communities that they had been separated from. I think many enslaved people fully recognized the tense relationships between Native peoples and missionaries. And I think they often saw opportunities within those tense relationships between Natives and missionaries to better their own condition. That is, they found opportunities at the mission stations to gain some autonomy, right? To go to church meant not working for a few hours, right? Finding a way of escaping from a labor regime, for example. Finding a way to have social interactions and contact with other enslaved people that they might not have encountered in their daily routines.
Did the missions give enslaved people opportunities to resist the control of their Native American masters?
I don't know that the missionaries gave those opportunities for resistance as much as the enslaved people created and seized those opportunities. That is, I don't think the missionaries were really intent on pursuing an anti-slavery or abolition campaign among the Native peoples where they were living and working. I do think that the enslaved people saw opportunities to ameliorate their condition. Right, whether that took the form of laboring at the mission stations rather than on their owners' farms and plantations. Some enslaved people, for example, successfully negotiated to have missionaries hire them as laborers rather than remain on their master's farms or plantations. And I think that for some enslaved people, that was an opportunity to distance themselves from what could be a grueling labor regime on a plantation. Some enslaved people were able to capitalize on missionaries' discomfort with chattel slavery by convincing missionaries to purchase them, purchase that enslaved person, and allow him or her to work off the price of their purchase, right? That is a sort of gradual emancipation through a negotiated labor arrangement. But that was not so often initiated by the missionaries, and I think much more often initiated by enslaved men and women themselves.
Can you talk about the extent to which these black people engaged in spiritual practices away from the missions and also from their masters?
So many enslaved people in the Choctaw communities look to the mission stations as one outlet for Christian practices. But it seems clear from the records that people are also gathering on their own, gathering just in communities of enslaved people, often at night, often in secret, to worship according to their own traditions, their own beliefs, with their own interests and goals in mind. And this, I think, resonates very much with what we know about enslaved people's religious practices throughout the South in the early 19th century, right? That there's a fair amount of evidence that allows us to consider the ways in which enslaved people look to Christianity as both a sword and shield, right? As a way of sort of relieving themselves of the sense of burden of their enslavement, and also as the source of inspiration for combating their exploitation, either directly resisting their masters or having a sense of spiritual deliverance in the future. And there's some really lovely records that talk about the preachers who emerge from the enslaved community in the Choctaw Nation, of people who meet just with other enslaved people, who preach to them, who teach them. There are some accounts of people singing, gathering to sing spirituals at night or to sort of steal away from the fields and replenish their souls and their sense of community with each other through religion.
How does this play into what the late feminist historian Stephanie Camp called arrival geography?
Stephanie Camp's work was so central to my thinking about this idea of the use of space and different people's competing uses of space in the Choctaw Nation. And certainly, I think the ways in which enslaved people seized and used space within the nation, whether it was the space at the mission stations or spaces in the woods or in the fields, for their own purposes and infused those spaces with meanings that had value to enslaved people, is very much in line with Stephanie Camp's idea of rival geography, right? That is, that plantation owners have a view of space in terms of work and control and subordination, and enslaved people used those same spaces for their own purposes and with their own interests, and often at odds with their master's desires.
Barbara Krauthammer is my guest. She's an associate professor of history at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. We'll take a short break and return and speak more with Barbara. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Barbara Krauthammer is my guest. She teaches history at UMass Amherst. She's author of Black Slaves, Indian Masters, Slavery, Emancipation, and Citizenship in the Native American South, which is the first full-length study of chattel slavery and the lives of enslaved people in the Choctaw and Chickasaw Indian Nations. And she's also co-author with Deborah Willis of the book Envisioning Emancipation, Black Americans and the End of Slavery. You can find links to Barbara and her work on our website, againstthegrain.org. Okay, so we have this complex dynamic. On the one hand, you have these black slaves, then you have the Choctaw Indians, many of whom own these black slaves. You have the missionaries coming in, you have the white settlers coming in, you have the federal government with its agenda. I'm interested in how Euro-American elites compare the racial traits and the perceived racial fitness of Indians on the one hand and black people on the other.
I think for the most part in the early 19th century, certainly among many Euro-Americans, there was a sense that Native peoples had much greater potential, or what they might have called much greater racial fitness, as it were, for assimilation into the American mainstream. And I think there was always a sense that people of African descent could never be assimilated into the American mainstream. Even among those people, missionaries included, who claimed to abhor slavery, certainly in the early 19th century, that abhorrence of slavery, I think, was based more on sort of ideas of humanitarianism rather than an actual interest in black people's individuality and individual humanity.
You also write that certain missionaries did look more favorably on black believers than perhaps on Indian non-believers.
Right. So that was another interesting and certainly very contradictory aspect to the research that I did, that I think missionaries were in many ways very sympathetic towards black believers, black Christians, and in many ways relied on them to aid the colonial project of converting Native peoples, right? That many enslaved African Americans in the Choctaw Nation could speak both English and the Choctaw language. And so the missionaries relied on them to work as interpreters and translators. And so I do think that the missionaries felt a sense of Christian affinity with enslaved believers. And yet, on the other hand, I don't think the missionaries ever saw the enslaved African Americans as fully human, as people who really merited true autonomy and human dignity.
How were the blacks who did become interpreters, intermediaries of a sort between the missionaries and the Native Americans, how were these blacks treated?
So they were treated fairly well by the missionaries because the missionaries were really dependent on them, right? So a really interesting reversal of what we think of as the more familiar racial hierarchy of white dominance and black subordination, that this was a moment where missionaries would write that they were really dependent on the services of their translator and interpreter, because those were the people who had not only the language skills, but also really a sense of cultural fluency and could serve as cultural brokers between the missionaries and Native peoples.
What about how enslaved blacks thought of their Indian masters, in this case their Choctaw Indian masters?
I think the range of opinion that enslaved people had about their masters in many ways parallel the kind of things that we see coming from enslaved people in other parts of the South. That is to say, many enslaved people spoke, sometimes quite openly and sometimes in veiled terms, about their masters' cruelty, right? About the separation of children from their parents, for example, right? The sale of children. And so there's some really striking testimonies of women remembering the sound of crying babies being taken from their mothers and sold to traders who are passing through. And so I think there is a very clear understanding among enslaved people that their native masters in many respects hold the ultimate control over their lives, over their well-being. There is also a fair amount of evidence that indicates the sexual abuse of enslaved women. Right? All of subsequent generations through the 19th century and through the Civil War of African Americans who claim Native ancestry will often give personal testimony either in official settings or to government agents, for example, or in less official settings, and will say things like, my mother was a slave and my father was her master. And they're certainly not talking about loving domestic scenes of marriage and household, right? They're much more likely gesturing towards histories of rape and sexual exploitation. So I think that is one important component that is sometimes neglected when we think about what's clearly a very troubling and painful history for many people. And certainly there were people who looked upon their masters with a degree of kindness and recognized their masters as being more humane rather than less humane in terms of the treatment they meted out towards enslaved people, right? So masters who did not separate families by sale or masters who did not beat their laborers. But that's a bit of a bittersweet pill, right? If you have to be grateful that you weren't whipped or grateful that you weren't sold away from your children, puts gratitude, I think, in a difficult light.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Barbara Krauthammer is my guest. She's an associate professor of history at UMass Amherst, and she's author of Black Slaves, Indian Masters. We are talking specifically about a chapter she wrote about missionaries, slaves, and Native Americans in the U.S. Deep South, a chapter that she contributed to the volume Formations of United States Colonialism. So, as you write, the missionaries actually, they didn't get enough funding, or they didn't get the funding that they desired, so that they, to some degree, relied on Native American communities for funding and resources. And as you said before, earlier this hour, I guess it was good that some Indians did welcome the missions and missionaries into their communities and thus were able to provide the missionaries with some of the resources they needed. Something then did turn, though. There was sort of a change in Indian perceptions of missionaries. And, of course, it was always kind of ambivalent, and different people thought differently of the missionaries. But what happened, especially in relation to laws passed by the Choctaw that were very unfriendly toward the missionaries and their activities?
As relations between the Choctaw Nation, the nation's leadership, and the U.S. federal government became increasingly tense, I think more Choctaw leaders became increasingly wary of the missionaries' presence in their nation and increasingly viewed missionaries not as a source of strategic tools and strategic information, but viewed missionaries more as outsiders who, at the end of the day, were going to ally themselves with the federal government and with U.S. colonial missions and interests. And so Choctaw legislators become increasingly take an increasingly harsh stance towards the missionaries and impose strict limits on the kinds of contact that missionaries can have with enslaved people. And so in part, it's a way of constraining the missionaries, right, by passing laws that say missionaries can no longer instruct enslaved people in reading and writing and can no longer permit enslaved people to learn to read and write at the mission stations. So those kinds of laws are being passed. And while they're definitely aimed at the missionaries, I would also argue that those laws are also aimed at enslaved people. And that those laws that are ostensibly directed towards curbing missionaries' contact with enslaved people, constraining missionaries' ability to move through the Choctaw Territory, for example, that those laws are very much about curbing enslaved people's access to autonomy at the mission stations, curbing enslaved people's opportunities to negotiate with missionaries for their purchase and ultimate manumission. And so that those laws really serve a dual purpose, and that ultimately what those laws represent is an attempt by the native government to bolster its autonomy, right? And to sort of reaffirm native people's right to self-government.
And if we step back, you know, there's these categories, these names we assign to people like colonizer and colonized. And in your writings, you try and trouble that distinction, which is often presented as a very clear, demarcated line. So what have you told us this hour that you think plays into your effort to try and call that distinction into question?
Well, I think all of this history, right? If we look seriously at Native American history in the U.S. South and in the U.S. as a whole, we certainly have to trouble some of the ideas about white supremacy, right, vis-a-vis African Americans. And initially, that was what drew me to this work, that here were people negotiating about slavery, but it wasn't just a contest between white and black, right? That there were Native peoples playing really important roles in what we think of as national debates in the United States about the future of slavery in the southern states. And so I think that by taking Native people seriously as historical actors, we necessarily change the terms and the terrain of our understanding of U.S. history. And I think that taking seriously the difficult and painful and often controversial dimensions of some of this history of African American enslavement in Native communities can best be done with a degree of sensitivity towards the ways in which Native peoples were really brutally targeted and subjugated by the dominant U.S. culture and government, and that at the same time, that never stripped them of their sense of agency and their sense of autonomy and their sense of self, right, of cultural viability, of political viability, and of determination, and that sometimes that played out, that sense of agency played out in terms of subjugating other peoples and in terms of negotiating between the institution of slavery and U.S. efforts to subordinate Native peoples. And so I think that there are complex dynamics that once we really look at Native peoples seriously as historical actors and as fully developed, complicated people like everybody else in the story, that the terms automatically change.
And I think one thing that makes your work so important is that the place of enslaved Africans and African Americans in the very complicated relationships between missionaries and Indians, and also in the larger story of U.S. efforts to subjugate Indians in the Deep South, that story has gone largely unexamined. Why do you think that is?
I think there's an interesting parallel between the removal of Native peoples from the Deep South and the removal of Native peoples from our historical narratives, right? That there has been this erasure of Native American history and Native American peoples. And in part, I suppose the cynic in me would say that's the function of colonialism and white supremacy, right? This erasure and sort of a simplified narrative. I have really had the benefit of having a number of colleagues at different schools in different departments who have also been interested in this history of Native American, African American intersections. And so I think that there is a small but growing cohort of scholars and some really wonderful students and junior scholars who are really committed to thinking seriously about Native American history and the relationship between Native American history and what we call U.S. history.
Well, could part of the explanation also lie in the fact that, you know, it's not really politically correct, perhaps, to bring up the fact that Indians owned blacks?
Right. It's a difficult and painful history for many reasons to discuss Native peoples' ownership and exploitation of African Americans. And it's certainly not the only history of African-American, Native American interaction in the Deep South, but I think it's an important history. And I think that we do ourselves and our students a disservice by ignoring it. And I think only by coming to terms with the complicated nature of this history can we better understand some of the current events that continue to revolve around the legacies of slavery and questions of race and racism in the West today.
On AgainstTheGrain.org, you'll find links to the faculty page of my guest, Barbara Krauthammer, who teaches at the University of Massachusetts Amherst, to her book, Black Slaves, Indian Masters, and to the book, Formations of United States Colonialism, in which you can find the chapter that we have been discussing today. Thanks so much, Barbara, for joining us.
Thank you. It was my pleasure.
I want to thank Carolyn Gorse at WMUA for her technical assistance with today's program. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources and links, and a way to sign up for our podcast. And check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical. Your online antidote to corporate media crap.